added for good measure. But how do you fancy doing this? Before we find out the finer detail of Rachel Reeves' budget later today, which of course will be live on LBC, well, why don't we make a list together of all the things that need more money? It doesn't have to be the single biggest thing that you think needs more investment. Just all the things in the UK today that need or would massively benefit from more investment.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Chancellor's expected to use her budget this lunchtime to freeze income tax thresholds to raise billions of extra revenue for the Treasury. The policy would drag more people into a higher tax band as their earnings grow. Rachel Reeves previously criticised the measure under the Tories, accusing them of picking the pockets of working people. In a video released by the Treasury, Ms Reeves has promised to make fair but necessary choices.
I know that there is more to do. I know that the cost of living is still bearing down on family finances. I know that people feel frustrated at the pace of change or angry at the unfairness in our economy. I have to be honest that the damage done from austerity, a chaotic Brexit and the pandemic were worse than we thought.
Separately, hundreds of tractors are descending on central London to protest last year's inheritance tax changes. Police stopped around 20 of them in Westminster this morning over fears of serious disruption. Farmers argue taxing their land risks their livelihoods, but ministers insist the changes make reliefs fairer. Shadow Farming Minister Robbie Moore joined the protest.
The family farm tax, the family business tax are going to have catastrophic consequences on many of those family farming businesses right across the country and the wider supply chain. The inheritance tax changes are going to decimate our farming industry and, of course, lead to food inflation prices.
You can hear the budget live and in full here on LBC and then join Sheila Fogarty for all the reaction and analysis. In other news this morning, American diplomats will meet separately with Ukrainian and Russian officials as talks over Donald Trump's peace plan continue. The US president has removed the Thanksgiving deadline for getting a deal done, saying good progress is being made. The army is pausing the use of its new Ajax tanks after soldiers suffered hearing issues during a training exercise at the weekend. Similar problems were reported in the summer. Pets at Homes admitted urgent and necessary measures are needed to turn the business around after a dip in earnings. Retail profits dropped by 84% to £3.5 million in the 6 months to October. The group says cost cutting will be a key part of its retail revival plan. And a general strike in Belgium is expected to cause widespread issues today. No flights are scheduled to take off from the country's biggest airport. It's also expected to impact domestic trains and Eurostar services. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 19 at 96.29. The pound buys $1.31 and a euro 13. LBC weather, sunny spells for southern and eastern areas today. Rain will spread eastwards, a high of 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Let's hear from the Chancellor, Geoffrey.
From the Chancellor, Nigel. Chancellor, John.
Norman.
Kenneth.
Gordon.
Alistair.
George.
Philip.
Sajid.
Rishi.
Nadine.
Kwasi.
Jeremy.
And now, Rachel. Another year, another budget. Over the past 40 years, we've seen it all. Our experts will continue to filter through the noise and uncertainty, helping you make the most of your tax allowances. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest through it all. Capital at risk. Tax rules applying can change.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. 3 minutes after 10 is the time, and this is my serious voice because there is a budget later today. So can we all please, please remember to be very grown up during the course of today's discussions? That won't last very long, will it? I still want to do a live phone. I'd love to do a phone in on why I'm suddenly much more interested in a budget than I ever have been before. I think it's more for political reasons than fiscal reasons. I appreciate not everybody is ready to hear this, but the first 18 months or so of Keir Starmer's administration has been disastrous by any measure. They've done lots of good stuff and failed to get it in front of the public, for which they don't necessarily need to shoulder all the responsibility, but the cultish nature of people pretending that it has been anything other than catastrophic in countless ways is getting rather tired. And I don't know why, but this budget feels a little bit like a sort of last chance saloon for the oil tanker to be turned around. And listen, I hate saying that. I wish it wasn't true, but it is. And that might be why. I don't think it's an interest born particularly of personal impact. I've always had a curious mixture of insulation and ignorance when it comes to budgets. If the Tories are in power, I'll probably come out of it slightly better off than I went into it. Except in Liz Truss's case, where if her things had actually landed, I'd have been considerably better off than I would have been otherwise. It's just everybody else, practically, who would have been worse off. And if Labour are in power, then I generally come out of a budget paying it more next year than I did last year. That seems to me to be how it works, and it seems to me to be how things should be, the natural order of things. At this point, were I made of slightly more selfish stuff, I'd start screaming about the squeezed middle and how we're already paying too much and how we work. I think the correct phrase, forgive the temporary profanity, the correct phrase is we work bloody hard and all our money is going to sponges and refugees. That is how you create the environment in the which people lucky enough to have a few quid are required to pay a few quid to the benefit of the entire population, the entire country, and of course the benefit of people who don't have a few quid. Make a list of things that the taxes go on and we'd be here all day. It's extraordinary, isn't it, how we can speak so blithely about our resistance to taxation as relatively ordinary citizens who rely upon things like the National Health Service, like the state school system, like roads and infrastructure, or like the army is quite a nice thing to have, the police quite a nice thing to have. You can tell how valuable something is by how violently it got cut after David Cameron became Prime Minister. You know, libraries, they're nice, aren't they? Cut them, close them, get rid of them. The police, they're quite important to ordinary people. In fact, I'd argue the more ordinary you are, the more important the police are. The less likely you are to be living in a gated community or having the benefits of a private police force around the corner. Or indeed, the chief constable on speed dial if your watch gets nicked, so you can ring him up, get a little pat on the back and be on the phone to be on the blower to the Daily Telegraph by tea time. The more ordinary we are, the more we rely upon the police. So what did David Cameron do when he got in? Cut them. Teachers, state schools, well, what should we do there? Cut them. Teaching assistants, cut them. What do we need? What does our tax money go on? Old age pension, yeah, well, I mean, let's not mention that today when we start talking about all the people who are going to get all the money that is going to be rinsed from all the people who work bloody hard. Copyright, right-wing media, 2021, 2022, 2023, 2024, 2025. And onwards, forevermore. Forevermore. And it's odd, isn't it, that we only ever really examine these issues from that perspective. And we're guilty. We did it on this programme. We did it on this programme as well. And the way that we've done it on Monday and Tuesday of this week was initially with the, yesterday with the mansion tax and the day before that with the, what was it the day before that? Was it income tax? It wasn't income tax, but it was another point upon which you say these people are clearly going to have to pay a little bit more. Just the freezing of the tax thresholds on this. So it was income tax, but it wasn't a rise in income tax. And the fact that more people are going to move into a higher rate of tax because as their wages go up, their thresholds will not be going up. And that led us, of course, to the question of whether or not we give too much to pensioners, whether we are too generous to pensioners in this country. I think they're set to get 550 quid a year more as a consequence of what will be announced today. So whether you're talking to pensioners or whether you're talking to people who live in nice houses or, crucially, because this is how it works, people who think they might be living in a really expensive house one day, pensioners, people who live in really expensive houses, people who work, quotes, I'm going to say blumming now, because some people still have understandable sensitivities about what used to be ruder words than they are now. People who work blumming hard and don't think that anybody else does, and think that the real definition of how hard you work is how much you earn, which is about as far from reality as it's possible to imagine, but it's still a very important a point of political salience. So there's not really much point me saying, should you be paying more tax? Because most people are going to say no. More people than we realise are going to say yes, as we occasionally manage to prove on this programme. Voices that are heard pretty much nowhere else in the British media. Should you be paying a little bit more tax? Yes, I should, actually. Should you be paying a mansion tax on your £2.5 million house? Well, I'd rather not, because, you know, I could spend the money on sweets. But obviously, in the great scheme of things, when I think about the state of the country and what has been done to it, and I managed to tamp down the fact that the things that were done to this country were largely done by people on the other side of the political divide, most obviously austerity and Brexit, then I accept that, yes, I should probably be putting my shoulder to the wheel, because if I don't, who will? They are perhaps the most ignored voices. Those of us who recognise that we need to put our shoulder even harder to the wheel for no reason other than that we can. That's it. That's the only reason why it's you. Because you can. You can't go after people who can't put their shoulder any harder to the wheel. The announcement yesterday that people who choose to spend a fixed rate allowance and chip in more of their own money and savings to get a more luxurious car on the Motability scheme are going to be prevented from doing that is one of the most hideous policy announcements imaginable. Genuinely, it just is, because it doesn't save a penny. As far as I can make out from my understanding of the Motability scheme, it doesn't save taxpayers a single penny. It simply means that people who are eligible for Motability won't be able to use the money that they are eligible to receive to buy BMWs or Audis, because it upsets a couple of racists. Well, not even racists, actually, is it? Because that shift from attacking foreigners to attacking the disabled is as old as the hills. It attacks a couple of bigots. It upsets a couple of bigots on Twitter, and the next thing you know, it's government policy. But please, send me more texts challenging the point that the Labour Party, the Labour government, has got off to an unimaginably awful start. So, let's make a list. It's almost December. Yeah, that's when we start making lists, isn't it? A little bit sooner if you're a little bit younger, but we can make a list. And let me make one thing absolutely clear. God, I sounded like a politician then. Let me be clear, he says before obfuscating violently. Let me be clear. This doesn't have to be the single most important thing in your life. I just want to make a list of things that you think Rachel Reeves should announce more money for later today. Live on LBC, straight after PMQs, I clock off a little bit early, hand the baton to Sheila, and you will barely notice the segue or the seam. So, who wants to go first? Shall I go first? Okay, I'll go first, if you insist. And I'm trying to think of less obvious, so the NHS, obviously. But if you are in the NHS, I want you to draw, here's the thing, right? I want you to draw on the thing that is unique to you. The thing that is unique to you. And by that I mean your life. The thing that is unique to you is your perspective on the world. Because only you can be you. So it means that when I say to you, what do you think Rachel Reeves should be spending more money on? A very different question from saying who should be taking the money off. And I suspect the answer is a kind of corollary. Who should the money be coming from? Not me. Who should the money be spent on? Me. Does that sound fair? Does that sound reasonable? Again, there's probably some voices who think they should be putting their own shoulder a little bit harder to the wheel without seeing any personal benefit, because they believe in something called society. Or if you want to get a little bit 2025 about it, they are what we might call proper patriots, people who are happy to pay more to enhance and increase the health of the country, even though the people who would benefit from that money going in are not the people putting it in, they are other people. People less fortunate, people less well rewarded, people less well paid. But if you were to make that, if you were to put one thing on that list because of who you are and what you do, because of who you are and what you do, what would it be? And it can be very, very I don't know why. I think partly because of the conversations that we had yesterday about children who can't go to school and the huge contrast between experiences of what schools can and do. I've reached for teaching assistants. I haven't got the statistics in front of me on how many the Tories got rid of, because I think we can all agree that the 2008 financial crisis was caused by there being too many teaching assistants in Kidderminster. But clearly, schools are less equipped to cope with the explosion of special needs that we've seen in recent years, partly, but not exclusively, down to the consequences and the impacts of COVID and lockdowns. And screens, I suspect, when it comes to children arriving at school unable to communicate properly. But the idea that schools need less staff, need fewer assistants. Anyway, that's it. I don't need to go on about it forever. That's one of the things that occurred to me first this morning. So that would be at the slightly more serious end of the scale. At the silly end of the scale, and just because I'm not a massive motorist doesn't mean I'm not a massive road user, whether as a passenger or on my bicycle. I honestly think, and don't laugh, don't snigger, you know what I'm going to say, I honestly think that potholes are a kind of litmus test of a society's health or a community's health. It was in New York, wasn't it, a few decades ago, that they talked about zero tolerance. And the idea was that if you had a broken window, then it creates an environment in which people are less likely to feel pride in their area, and therefore antisocial behaviour and even criminality would become more likely to thrive. I don't know whether subsequent academic inquiry has found this to be true or not, but it feels true, doesn't it? If there's graffiti near you, if there's a tatty flag dangling from a lamppost outside your house, we might talk in a middle-class way about how it's bringing down property values, but actually in a classless way, in a class-blind way, we're talking about how it makes us feel less proud of our area, less proud of our community. It looks... I think potholes are a massive part of that. I really do. You may completely disagree, in which case I'd defend myself by pointing out that I've already called for teaching assistants to be an area upon which Rachel Reeves has spent a bit more money. But I honestly think if you could make people's roads nicer, the roads they live on, the roads they drive on, they would feel a little bit more pride. And it's one of the most measurable improvements as well, because you really notice, don't you, especially if you're on a bicycle, you really notice this issue. And if it's fixed, you will notice that it's been fixed. 16 minutes after 10. Some of the stuff we don't know enough about. Obviously, you would imagine that rough sleeping would be fairly high up on the list. But do we know how spending more money on, quotes, rough sleeping, end quotes, would work? How it would look? The sense that people aren't getting looked after when they should be. But what would even looking after people mean? Given that, you know, the journey to the streets, ending up on the streets, begins with not being on the streets. So the processes and the practices that lead people to that incredibly vulnerable end are not necessarily easily solved just by calling for them to be solved. But it still might be something you'd put on the list. Put on the list anything you want. And listen, this is your starter for 10, or your starter at 10, 17. It's not what I'm suggesting for a minute are the most important issues. They're just the ones that I like. They're just the ones that occurred to me this morning. So I will stress for the final time, this is not about the thing you think is most important for the country. It's just your contribution to a long list, a long and growing list. Instead of shouting at each other about who should and should not be paying for the necessary increases in public expenditure, let's talk instead about where those increases in public expenditure should be. And you can come at it from the shallow end or the deep end. All I ask is that you tell me what it is that you would like to see Rachel Reeves announce a little bit more money for later today, and why that is the thing today that you have decided to cite. Nobody is suggesting for a minute that it is the most... Well, you can, of course, also bring me the thing that you think is by far the most important, but that is not a requirement of participation this morning. The only requirement of participation is that you have an idea in your head and you are prepared to share it with the rest of us, with the class. You're prepared to share it with the class. Would you like to know the phone number? 0345 6060973 is the number you need if you'd like to contribute. It's the same number, by the way, if you want to send me a WhatsApp. And if you want to send me a text, the number you need is 84850. So here's the list. What are you going to put on it? Rachel Reeves is going to announce spending later today. What would you like to hear on her list? Not necessarily at the top, but on it. And the longer the list, the more, I think, illustrative this conversation will be. 10:19, hit the numbers now, you will get through.
The Budget. Have your say only on LBC.
Cybersecurity matters more than ever for businesses across the UK. LBC's been exploring how cyber attacks happen, who's behind them, and the steps you can take to protect your business.
Really simple things that a small business can do today is educating employees. It's imperative that we think about cybersecurity not just as a tech thing, but it's really a human thing. It's all about the human behind the computer and training your team to really be aware.
Watch the full interview on our free Global Player app. Thanks to BT Business, LBC.
At Harwoods, we know your car says a lot about you. Maybe that you like to make an entrance, or you'd rather make your escape. That you want to cut a dash, or just cut your emissions. That you like to take the bends, or bring your four-legged friends. Whatever, we speak your language. Come and have a chat at Harwoods Audi Crawley and Five Oaks, and Harwoods Volvo Crawley. Details at harwoods.co.uk. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
We all want to live well and age well. That means having independence and positive choices to enjoy the life we choose. That's what Elmbridge in Cranley is all about. A place of fun, a friendship, in a hive of activity. But above all, it's a place to put your independence and well-being first. To find out more about Elmbridge in Cranley, visit our website today at retirementvillagers.co.uk/Elmbridge.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
20 minutes after 10 is the time. I should have also given you a quick heads up about what's coming up later on the programme. Obviously, we've got PMQs at 12, and then we've got the live budget at 12:30. At 11, I'm minded to talk about the essential end of jury service for a large number of trials, something about which I have a sneaking suspicion. You will persuade me that I'm wrong, but we can find out from 11. And I've also spoken to the historian who has been censored by the BBC for correctly describing President Trump as the most openly corrupt American president in history. And, of course, the use of the word openly is both pertinent and crucial. Extraordinary to invite somebody to give four wreath lectures at the BBC, who is known for his incredibly trenchant and incisive views on democratic threat, democratic breakdown, on authoritarian overreach. And then when he starts describing authoritarian overreach, the BBC censor him. No doubt all the free speech bros will be along in a moment, but I haven't heard much from them yet. All that to come. We begin, though, with the things that we, by which I mean you, would most like to see Rachel Reeves announce a little bit more spending on later today. Steve's in Gillingham. Steve, what do you reckon?
Good morning, James. Big fan of your work.
Thank you, mate.
The easiest thing is to say what's missing, but as we're trying to do, obviously, today, is the hardest thing to say is how to fix it.
Yes.
And where it should be spent to. It's a horrible thing to think about. I mean, I'm just casting my mind back to 20 plus years ago when I used to be involved in like youth work services. I used to work for a music company, and right. so and the live bands, and we were like doing like drum and bass gigs and DJing, and we took it to the next level by hitting up the government for an Awards for All National Lottery grant.
Right.
And we set ourselves up in a local community centre, teaching the kids in half term times, getting them off the street and teaching them DJ skills.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff just doesn't happen. And it's clear, because what happened with that community centre, they won an award from, well, they were voted as like most in need. They were in South East London. The Children in Need did a Dragon's Den special on this youth centre.
Wow.
And they gave them the money. Yeah, it was brilliant. Had a little bit on telly. And it was quite hard, because we're obviously going there and we're building this recording studio for the kids, walking past AMS1, Alan Sugar's Rolls Royce parked down a back street in Eltham, which was quite a hard contrast.
Although he's, I mean, listen, he oddly is one of the people who is quite a good example of getting your shoulder to the wheel. He's the only person I can think of who's actually posted online a cheque of his tax bill, his cheque to the Inland Revenue, and it was an eye-watering sum of money. So, let's not blame it all on Lord Sugar.
So what happened there is we built their recording studio. It was on Dragon's Den and it was on Children in Need. 3 years later, that recording studio's gone, all the instruments sold, no kids go there, and they are now, the only way they forced to keep the community centre open is by offering term time childcare to working parents, which is great.
Of course it is.
We need
and
more.
That's a Labour, I mean, it's got much bigger under Labour. There's a lot more term time childcare for working parents than there was under previous governments. It's another example of something they deserve more credit for, but... Yep. The silver lining has a cloud, and that is that the youth provision has disappeared entirely. And that's a really good example of something that costs money in the short term, but saves a lot of money in the long term.
Absolutely. It's engagement with the youth. And then also relevant engagement. They tried doing things like, bear in mind the area it was, they'd done like clown workshops and fancy dress workshops, and the kids would run riot. And it would be a waste of time, but it's relevant engagement with youth community and relevant engagement with things that they are actually interested in, which brought us to have quite a nice sort of business like 2001, 2002, helping people. It was just lovely. I was able to do my full-time job and I was able to help people in term time.
Describe it as youth support. I've been very Catholic this week on the programme with a capital C. I've been doing quite a lot of self-flagellation and mea culpa, but youth clubs used to be one of the things I was an arrogant idiot about. Because it's when people ring in to talk about subjects, if an answer is popping up all the time, I used to get a bit impatient with it because I want new stuff and original insights and perspicacious contributions. But that makes me an idiot because it also makes me quite arrogant because, of course, if young people have nowhere to go, they are more likely to do things we would rather they did not do. That's something that the Global Charity Makes Some Noise looks at as well. It's just giving people, particularly vulnerable young people, places to go, people to be, people to see. And it should be obvious. One text has got it. Steve's got it. He said, I tried making a list for you, then I realized the answer was everything. Everything needs more money. Nothing short of everything is under strain. Rachel Reeves later will explain how austerity, Brexit and Donald Trump's tariffs have made everything worse. But I don't think anyone can pretend that things weren't pretty bad to start with. And that's the point. That's why all the coverage of the budget, whether today or tomorrow, will be essentially disingenuous. Because it all pretends that there's some paradise, some Elysian field that we could all be dancing around in if only somebody else was in charge. Nonsense. But very seductive nonsense. Alan is in Blackpool. Alan, what are you putting on the list?
Good morning, James.
Hello, Alan.
Yeah, I'd like to put libraries on the list. Now, the reason I'm saying that is I had the pleasure some months ago of working as a volunteer at our local library just down the road, spending time with the children, reading with them, drawing pictures with them. And I saw what a fantastic, lovely, valuable time that was. Obviously, it's not about me. I got so much out of it, but I saw just the enjoyment.
Well, it is about you, actually. As a member of society, this is a utilitarian plus point. This is a good thing. You are being fulfilled by your contribution. Yeah. Your contribution is good for one reason, but what you get out of it is good for another. So it cuts both ways, actually.
Well, yes, yeah. I mean, I think I just sort of add to it. The children, they thoroughly enjoyed it. I got to know quite a few of them. As they got to know me, we'd spend time talking, we'd have a lot of fun together, and I just thought, what a fantastic time it was. I was saying to your researcher, I appreciate that every part of the country is going to have different issues, different funding, but I'd love to see this sort of rolled out, if it can be rolled out, and children to have the same, the same pleasure and the same things in life.
Yes, and it is of a piece with the previous contribution as well. In fact, the majority of calls coming in, if we were to add mental health services to it, CAMHS, and looking at my text, the idea that Rachel Reeves should be announcing things today that will make life better for young people is sounding pretty irresistible. Off the top of my head, apart from the increase in minimum wage, which is going to impact upon slightly older young people more than anybody else, off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that that fits into that category. But that is how parts, if not all, of the population feel. Who is most in need of help and support at the moment? Children, probably. And that is an interesting contrast, isn't it, to the conversation we had on Monday about pensioners, who will be, and I'm not getting involved in any pensioner bashing rhetoric, but they will be coming out of this budget, as they have with all previous budgets, a little bit better off than they did before, unless they've got enough private non-state pension income to push them into a higher tax threshold. But it will only be by a little bit, and the amount of income that is eligible for the higher tax threshold will be correspondingly small. So who will be coming out of this budget better off? Definitely pensioners. Will children? Will the average child? Yes, actually, because they're going to list the two-child benefit cap, which means in the home, things are going to get better for larger families. But outside the home, in the youth groups, in the libraries, in the child and young adult mental health services, are things going to get any better there? I do not know. So what would you put on this list? If we've got youth support, we've got libraries, my own ideas, teaching assistants, again for children. Is this a coincidence? What about adults? What do we need? What do you need? What do you want to see more money being spent on? 0345 6060973. If you were Rachel Reeves and you could operate in a political vacuum where you were simply doing what was best for the greater good of the country, the greater good of the population, or the greater good of you, your street, your community, what would you like to see a few more pounds spent on? Dominic Ellis is here with the headlines.
The Chancellor's expected to use her budget this lunchtime to freeze income tax thresholds to raise billions of pounds of extra revenue for the Treasury. The policy would drag more people into a higher tax band as their earnings grow. American diplomats will meet separately with Ukrainian and Russian officials as talks over Donald Trump's peace plan continue. The US president has removed the Thanksgiving deadline for getting a deal done, saying good progress is being made. And a general strike in Belgium is expected to cause widespread travel disruption today. Some Eurostar services have already been cancelled. LBC weather, sunny spells for southern and eastern areas. Some rain spreading eastwards through the day. A high of 12 degrees.
This is LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from real Octopus Energy calls.
Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
The customer service is really good.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
Your customer service was tip-top. You know, I couldn't fault it.
You've stepped it up, I think, for an energy company, so well done.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 10:32 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Just a word on pensions, which I give it another 10 years and I'll probably be obsessed by them, but I'm not at the moment. Pensions, pensioners. They may be better off than the rest of the population in the context of today's budget, most of them, but they're not actually better off in the context of other pensioners around the world, particularly around Europe. So even there, the question that should be hanging over every conversation that we have is why are we hit harder than everything else? John Major gave a speech earlier. John Major, former Prime Minister, made a speech detailing epic damage to our country, visited upon us. A damage done to our country, huge damage done to our country. A conservative former prime minister, so you can't chalk him up as some sort of lefty do-gooder, if that's the way you've been conditioned to think. A former conservative prime minister detailing epic damage done to our country by bad actors, by bad people. And you probably don't even know about it. What on earth would the subject matter be? It's so easy and so obvious to work out. A former prime minister from the Conservative Party delivers a big, prestigious speech at the London School of Economics detailing epic damage done to our country by people we can name and identify, and it goes almost entirely unreported. Don't let me go home without doing the reveal on that one. And speaking of very important speeches, the Reith lecturer, an author and historian called Rutger Bregman, one of the most prestigious appointments the BBC can make, an annual event, started with Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, a celebration of free speech and communication. He revealed yesterday that a single line from his first Reith lecture, which was broadcast yesterday morning, has been removed, been censored against his will by the BBC. And we'll be talking to him, not quite exclusively, but very interestingly, before 11 o'clock today. Henry is in Hackney on the question of what we should be spending money on. Henry, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Good to speak with you again. I was told explicitly of what we should spend money, and I'll just briefly start on kind of where I think we shouldn't spend money, right?
No, won't.
Okay, I won't. Fine. Absolutely not.
Everyone else does that.
Okay, yeah, no, fine. Well,
long list. I mean, you're a nice bloke, so you're probably going to go for, I don't know, guns, but someone else will ring in and go for refugees. And in some ways, they're both equally unhelpful contributions to the conversation. We are imagining that Rachel Reeves has the freedom to apportion money to the areas that we think it should be apportioned to, or we want to see it apportioned to. Spoiler alert, she doesn't really. But if she did, where would you want it to go?
So the UK has the best offshore wind resources in the world. I think
currently we
are. We've been. A YouTube video I watched the other day. It basically called us the Saudi. The UK has the potential to be the Saudi Arabia of wind energy, right? Which was news to me. We basically have the most.
Are you sure that wasn't the House of Lords?
Yeah, no, good one. But basically, so currently we're operating around 16 gigawatts of offshore wind, but basically we have the potential to scale to 43 to 50 gigawatts by 2030 and even to 125 gigawatts by 2050.
Well, of course we do, because we're an island, and we've got more shoreline than, I mean, like, in terms of the ratio between shoreline and land mass, we must be, like, really, really ahead of almost every other country we can think of.
Exactly, and it's also about the consistency of the wind. So, like, it sounds quite funny, but it's basically that, you know, because when it's not windy, it doesn't produce power, but we have the most consistent gusts, I think, in the world. This is what this YouTube video was.
My first band was called The Persistent Gusts. Stop now. It's sounding like at Sunday lunch. I'm sorry.
I love your band, so no,
carry on.
you've got to inject some humour into things. But anyway, so I just feel like, you know, while I won't talk about things that we shouldn't be spending money on, I feel like if we invested money into, you know, into green energy and rebuilding our kind of, or rebuilding the, because the problem is at the moment with productivity, right, because our energy bills are so expensive, everything is so expensive and it all comes back to energy. If we invest, you know, when they talk about taking on debt to invest rather than just like a Liz Truss, you know, lowering taxes and crashing the mortgage market. I feel like if we invested in something that's going to provide us with consistent, clean, long-term, reliable energy, and as well as that, it's going to create hundreds of thousands of well-paid engineering jobs, because they're going to have to go out there and actually build these windmills and these energy islands in the North Sea, off the coast of Norfolk, all around the country. So that would be where I'd put.
I'm part of the problem here, not part of the solution, because I don't talk about it enough. And part of the reason I don't talk about it enough is probably because I've been a little bit gaslit by the ecosystem that's been created. But the idea that the best thing you can do in terms of energy, from everybody's point of view, except the people who make a ton of money out of fossil fuels, is to focus much, much, much more heavily on the stuff that is free. Yes. I can't believe I have to say this out loud. Wind, sun, even hydroelectric power, which we're probably less well equipped for as a country than we are the offshore wind turbines. But, you know, you turn on your radio and Donald Trump is giving it some, or Farage is giving it some, or some other person who is
drill
either
baby
in the,
drill.
Drill baby drill in the pockets of the fossil fuels, or working for one of those lobby groups that calls himself a think tank. And they create the idea in public discourse that this isn't blooming obvious, and it just is, isn't it, right, to people like you and to anybody genuinely paying attention.
Totally. And right. And you talk just last point, when they talk about drill baby drill and talking about, you know, bringing down energy prices, what they fail to mention is that obviously that oil that would potentially be drilled out of the North Sea goes to the international markets. It's owned by private corporations, so it doesn't do anything to lower our energy bills. Now, if we had a time machine, we could go back and not sell North Sea to BP and nationalise it and create Equinor like Norway did, and now they've got a £3 trillion wealth fund. Yes. You know, that'd be fantastic. But
we haven't got a time machine.
Oh, no, unfortunately we don't. But,
and also was it Starmer or Miliband said this week that fossil fuels aren't necessarily the problem, or the people, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was as if there is a way of deploying fossil fuels that wouldn't be as environmentally damaging as they currently are, which is again unhelpful when the siren lure of energy that's infinite and constantly renewing should have just redefined humanity's relationship with energy years ago. But if you don't understand why it hasn't, then have a look at who was visiting the White House last week and treated like royalty, despite being widely believed to have ordered the murder of an inconvenient journalist. 10:40 is the time. Actually, for the avoidance of doubt, I'm talking about the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Thank you, Henry. Imran is in Newham. Imran, what are you putting on my list?
Hi, James. Your first time calling, so a little bit nervous.
Welcome
to me. Okay. So I was thinking, like a bursary system for, I don't know, medical staff like doctors, student nurses, etc., and teachers. So where they would go into university to study for it, they wouldn't have to take a student loan to pay for their studies. The government would fund for them specific professions.
That's nice, actually. That's quite progressive, isn't it? The idea that people whose contribution to society will be measured in non-financial ways should be relieved of some of the financial burden of getting the qualifications they need to make that contribution.
So then the thing being, once they're qualified, they have to obviously work within the country for a specific period of time, at least.
Or they have to pay back some of the money that they've received via a bursary. So if they want to up sticks to Australia, then we can't stop them, because that would be weird. But they'd then be on the hook for the bursary would then be recalibrated as a loan, almost.
Yes, and then the upside of that being, when they've actually started working, the student loan wouldn't be coming out of their salary, so their net figure at the end of the month would be higher, and then that would almost alleviate some of this junior doctors are getting paid too little.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot going on in this. Where did this come from? Are you going to be a doctor yourself?
No. My sister's a nurse, and obviously just speaking to her, and obviously seeing a lot of the media around junior doctors going on strike and whatnot, I'm just thinking, they used to have like a golden handshake for teachers back when I was at uni, back in 2002. Yeah. They used to like have a £5,000 golden handshake for teachers to try and encourage more people to go into the profession. And I think something like this,
there used to be a bursary for nurses as well. Sometimes the future is you can see it in the past. I don't know why either of those things got taken away, the handshake for teachers or the bursary for nurses, but I wouldn't be stunned into silence if it had something to do with austerity.
Yeah.
I love that, Imran. I love that. And I love that because, I mean, your sister notwithstanding, you're thinking about what would be best for society rather than what would be best for you. Like all our callers today, the green renewal energy, the libraries, the more support for young people, the child and adult mental health services. It's amazing, isn't it, how the conversation changes when you're asking people what they would like to see the Chancellor do to make the country better, to make it a healthier, happier place for everybody. Possibly not immediately yourself. Imran isn't going to benefit personally from what he describes, except in so far as having a NHS, which is full of people with higher morale and higher wages, or at least better income, higher income. And that is, I didn't know that this was going to work necessarily, but it is amazing how different the conversation feels. James puts it well, and he says, stop allowing all these sensible callers on, James. It's giving me hope. And then he adds, forlorn hope. Is it forlorn? Probably. In the context of what's going to be announced later today, it probably is. But in the context of remembering who we are and what we stand for as a country, it's sometimes rather helpful to have a little bit of a reminder of what real values look like and sound like. 10:43 is the time. David is in Guildford. David, what have you got?
Hello, James. Good morning to you.
But down to you, David. What are you putting on my list?
Litter. Not more of it, James. I see it. I sort of hark back to the golden days of people picking up litter, council employees and so forth. And I just think that a cleaner country would make everyone a bit more proud.
I still see people admittedly, I spend a lot of time in central London. Sadiq Khan's war zone, copyright Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, Daily Express, and latterly Donald Trump. And we still see it quite a lot around here. Is Guildford disappearing under a tidal wave of flotsam and jetsam?
Well, I think everywhere is. If you drive down motorways and main roads, I think everywhere is just slowly being swallowed by this
really
ever-growing tide of litter. I mean, I used to pick litter myself. And
professionally?
Sorry?
Professionally, or just as a sort of...
professionally, yeah, sort of. I was a village caretaker. So I used to go around and pick litter to tidy up the village.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, I mean, I don't know. I haven't actually noted an increase in litter. But
you
you're
need
right.
To get out more. You need to get out.
I can't.
More.
If I got out anymore, I'd have hypothermia at the moment. So I'm putting it on the same list as potholes, though. It's little improvements that sound at first glance to be, you know, less necessary than all the other things we've heard, but actually create a mood. They create a feeling that would be a net positive, quite a big net positive, because you're describing, really, pride in your community.
Yeah,
yeah.
Making people feel proud.
Yeah, making people feel a little bit more proud. It's the word I use, it's the word you use. It maybe want a slightly different word, just a little bit more at home. A little bit happier. Thank you, David. A few more calls on this, but I do want to play you this interview that I conducted earlier this morning with Rutger Bregman, who has delivered one of the four Reith lecturers at the BBC. And you know, this is not a place where BBC bashing is commonplace. I don't think I've ever worked for Rupert Murdoch, except writing a couple of book reviews for the TLS. And therefore, I am not somebody in the commercial British media dedicated to the destruction of the BBC, but they are getting almost everything wrong at the moment, and it's horrible to watch this sort of insidious takeover from within by people who claim to be scrupulously impartial but got knighted by Theresa May for services to the Conservative Party. I'll say that again. This chap Robbie Gibb, who I apologise if you've never heard of him because I've just been responsible for introducing you to his existence, but he claims to be scrupulously impartial. Claimed to have no editorial involvement when somebody unidentified gave him a ton of money to buy the Jewish Chronicle, which of course pursued a very, very pro Netanyahu line during the unfolding genocide in Gaza. But he also claimed in the House of Commons this week to be somehow scrupulously impartial. Quite an absolutely extraordinary intervention. So you can describe terrible things happening at the BBC without wanting its destruction. In fact, the good people in this conversation are worried that the bad people want its destruction, even though they've somehow got into the BBC. But they got this horribly wrong. Imagine inviting someone to give a lecture about authoritarian breakthrough, about the paralyzing cowardice of our elites when it comes to standing up to authoritarianism, about the threat that Donald Trump's depravity threatens or poses to Western democracy, and then censoring him for describing Donald Trump as the most openly corrupt president. Well, I'll do a proper introduction after this.
The Budget. Have your say only on LBC.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helps advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
There's always a lot going on. I'm on site getting the job done, running the business too, payments, invoices, admin, all on me. But now with Tap to Pay, I can take payments there and then, and Sage sorts the admin afterwards. Everything's sorted in the background so I don't spend hours doing it later. Magic.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping British businesses like Mike at Residual Electrical Contractors. That's more than artificial intelligence. That's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. T's and C's apply.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Back the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
Ow. Ow. Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down,
not off,
said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
Mm-hmm. A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with three tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
It's 10 minutes to 11 and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Rutger Bregman is a Dutch historian and author. He was invited to give the very, very prestigious Reith Lectures this year by the BBC. He told an audience of 500 people in London last month that Donald Trump was the most openly corrupt president in American history. Focus on the word corrupt. When it was broadcast on Radio 4 yesterday morning, should I mention briefly that among 30 to 54-year-olds in this country, there are now more people listening to me between 10 and 1, and indeed to you, than there are to Radio 4, to BBC Radio 4. And this perhaps will be a reason why some more people may head over in this direction. But the line had been removed. I spoke to him earlier and I began by asking him how he found out that a line in a speech in large part about the cowardly paralysis of so-called elites in the face of the authoritarian threat posed by people like Donald Trump, how he found out that the line had been excised from his Reith lecture.
I got a call last Wednesday from my senior editor. She was basically giving me the news that this decision had not been made yet, but that they were considering it and were wondering how I would respond. So I said, well, what do you think? Obviously, I said, like, I'm absolutely not okay with that. This is against my wishes, and I will share that with the public. And then I didn't hear anything for quite a few days until Monday, less than 24 hours before it was published. They said, yes, we're going ahead and doing it.
There are three more lectures to come. So for the benefit of anybody who missed this one, albeit the edited version of this one, the irony, for want of a stronger word, lies in the fact that in many ways you were addressing precisely the sort of censorship and control that you have become a victim of.
Exactly. That's honestly why I couldn't really believe it. Up until the very last moment, I thought, no, they're surely not going to do it. And then when you listen to BBC Radio 4, you know, and you hear your voice suddenly being cut. It's a very weird experience, James. I honestly have never experienced anything like it in my career. And like, people got to understand, this is not a lecture that is like, I wasn't freestyling behind the lectern, right? This is a text that was very polished. Like, we worked on it for months. I was asked to do this many, many months ago. And the whole team of the BBC Reef lectures was incredible. Like, I've worked with many editors in my life, and these people were really, really good and were giving me so much good advice on how to, you know, improve the text, make it more powerful. So when I was there 4 weeks ago in London in the BBC Radio Theater, I was really happy, and I honestly was quite proud. I was like, let's do this. And then to hear 4 weeks later that they're editing out a line out of fear, because I think that's basically what they've admitted, right? That it was because of legal reasons. Yeah, it's just profoundly disappointing.
I mean, I don't want to tempt you into the realms of speculation, but if Donald Trump hadn't reacted so strongly to the Panorama edit, do you think this would have happened?
I don't think so. And that's also what was suggested to me, that in normal times, this wouldn't have happened.
Who would the competition be then, do you think, if we could get inside the minds of the BBC Red Pencils? Who would they cite as the competition to the title of the most corrupt president, the most openly, because openly is crucial, but the most openly corrupt president in US history?
Well, look, I'm a historian, so when I say something like the most openly corrupt president ever, like, I think about that. Like, is this really true? Can I make this case? And I think the answer is yes. I made the decision to use the word openly, right? That's the big difference here with someone like Richard Nixon, for example, who was obviously also incredibly corrupt, in a way, maybe even more corrupt, but not openly. And Donald Trump and his family are obviously flaunting their corruption in a way that I think has been unheard of, also made possible because of modern media, of course. You could go back to the Gilded Age, right? The Gilded Age, late 19th century, was also an era of incredible corruption. But I think back then, it was mostly the system that was being corrupt. And actually, the presidents themselves were not that directly involved in the corruption. And again, it was not as openly. So I thought about this statement. Mm. I think it's defensible. I think it's plausible. I mean, people can criticize it, of course. I'm not saying like it's the truth, but it's not like I'm you know, sharing some conspiracy theory or something like that.
No, and I mean, for people who are familiar with the genesis of the Reith lectures and certainly the identity of the first Reith lecturer, it becomes sort of doubly or triply troubling, doesn't it? Because this is supposed to be an exercise in free speech. You've talked about the paralyzing cowardice of the media in the face of these kind of threats.
Exactly. And the first Reith lecturer was Bertrand Russell, my greatest intellectual hero, who was known as a staunch advocate for free speech, who was canceled when he came to America, right? He was sued by a mother from Brooklyn because she accused him of poisoning the minds of the young and spreading, you know, to free ideas about sex. So I don't know. The irony is just immense. And also the lecture itself is exactly about the cowardice of today's elites. It's about universities, corporations, and yes, also media networks bending the knee to the administration. And we've seen it in the US, right? Many, many big media networks like Disney, for example, just giving in to the pressure and to the bully. But this does feel a little bit different. Like, this is really removing a line from something that already went through the full editorial process.
Well, speaking of editorial processes, if you'd put this in a book, would you have expected any pushback at all from an editor or a publisher?
No. I've never, in my whole career, I've never experienced anything like it. It's surreal. And also, I was initially thinking, like, is this something peculiar about British media? Because I was obviously discussing with colleagues, like, for context, I'm Dutch, so I've spent a lot of time in media, and I was talking to about it to colleagues. And, everyone was just bewildered.
Why? I mean, this might seem like a stupid question. I want you to leave modesty aside if you can, Rutger. Mm. Why did they ask you to do it, to do the Reith lectures? Do you think?
Well, they said that they wanted to invite a provocative thinker. And I think that's what I am. And they said that this year's Wreath Lectures are a provocation. Like, that's literally the term that they used when they announced me as their Wreath Lecturer. So I think I kind of did my job. Didn't I? And even, like, I mean, that sentence, Donald Trump being the most openly corrupt president, I mean, it's a little bit like an offhand remark, right? The reason I say it is because I'm like, I don't want to make this a boring lecture. We already know this. Now I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes dunking on my own side. Yes. So I spent most of the time criticizing the weak European Union, weak centrists, weak liberals, failing leftists. I mean, that's what I spent most of my time on.
Was there any pressure put on you to keep this under your hat? Because, the phrase Streisand effect springs to mind from the BBC's point of view.
Yeah.
Drawing a lot more attention to the bit that they cut than it probably would have received if they hadn't cut it in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no pressure.
Sure.
So it's not that they threatened me with, I don't know, lawsuits or anything like that. But they certainly asked me if I could, you know, not say this.
Okay.
But for me, that was, I mean, ethically, that was obviously not an option. But also pragmatically, I mean, there were 500 people in the BBC radio theater when I gave the lecture. There was already someone leaking about it to the Daily Mail. So I'm pretty sure it would have come out anyway. And actually, I saw people on social media, before I had posted this, they were already saying, like, hey, what is happening here? Was something just cut? You can very clearly, in my view, hear it in the edit that a line has been removed.
It's good that we can smile about it, but I don't think anyone will be unaware of the seriousness of what you're describing. So finally, Rutger, if you would, a word on what you've described as authoritarian breakdown, a word on where this event sits in the bigger picture of what you describe and what you have articulated your fear of.
My fellow historian Timothy Snyder has written a brilliant book on tyranny that was published shortly after Trump was first elected. And it contains a couple of lessons that we need to remember in times like this when there's a real risk of an authoritarian breakthrough. And the first lesson was the lesson that I kept thinking about in the last week. It was, do not obey in advance. And that is exactly what the BBC has done. Like, there was no direct threat from the Trump administration. The Trump administration, I don't think they give a damn about who I am. I've said this many times anyway, but they were still fearful and they still thought, let's not do it. They presumably thought that the British tabloids, you know, are going to turn this into a big thing and say, oh, they've invited a left-wing lunatic to insult the great president. I honestly think that's why the decision was made. They cited legal advice from lawyers and suggested that it was not up to them and that, you know, the lawyers had decided. But that's not how it works, right, James? It's lawyers never decide. It's leaders who decide. And I think they've made the wrong decision.
Rutger Bregman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Chancellor is expected to announce that a freeze on income tax thresholds will be extended in the budget this lunchtime. The policy would potentially drag more people into a higher tax band as their earnings grow. It could create 1 million extra taxpayers and generate $8 billion a year for the public purse, former Tory Chancellor. Lord Hammond says Rachel Reeves has boxed herself into a corner.
The Chancellor can't borrow more, not just because of her fiscal rules, but because of the market's willingness to lend. So she's constrained on borrowing, which means there are three other options. Get the economy growing faster, raise taxes, or cut spending. So if she can't cut spending, she's going to have to raise taxes.
Other measures in the budget could include the scrapping of the two-child benefit cap. That would mean larger families could claim more means-tested benefits. A wealth or mansion tax could also be announced. Billionaire hotel magnate Surinder Arora says that would be counterproductive.
We must celebrate the success of successful people, entrepreneurship. We'd rather have more people in the country rather than scare them away. And actually, those people stay in the country are going to hopefully contribute more to the nation.
You can hear the budget live and in full here on LBC from 12:30 and then join Sheila Fogarty for all the reaction and analysis. In other news this morning, local media reports in Hong Kong say four people have died in a high-rise building fire. Online footage shows flames and smoke engulfing the building in the Tai Po district. President Trump says talks to end the war in Ukraine have made tremendous progress. Russian attacks have continued on Ukraine overnight, with drone strikes in Zaporizhia reportedly injuring 19 people. A general strike in Belgium is expected to cause widespread travel disruption. Some Eurostar and domestic train services have been impacted. Workers are protesting against the government there and their plans to reduce the national debt. The two police forces are testing a virtual assistant to answer non-emergency questions from the public. Bobby will be on the beat in areas covered by Thames Valley Police and the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary. Officials say it'll be an extra communication tool but can't be used as an alternative to a 999 call. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 27 at 96.37. The pound buys $1.31 and a euro 13. LBC weather, sunny spells for southern and eastern areas. Rain will spread eastwards later, a high of 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Markets react to the latest updates outlined in the autumn.
Attention turns to Westminster.
Headlines change, but smart investors stay prepared. With IG, invest commission-free on all stocks and shares. Plus, earn 4% AER variable interest on your uninvested cash while you plan your next move. Whatever the autumn budget brings, stay in control at IG.com. Your capital's at risk. Qualifying criteria applies. Valid on SIP, GIA and ISA products only. Other fees may apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 11 is the time. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rutger Bregman. If you're kind of trying to place where you came across him before, he's the guy that kind of set the world on fire when he was giving an address to the World Economic Forum, I think it was, in Davos, when he talked about universal basic income. And he's also written some brilliant books, one of which sits rather neatly with some of the things we were saying in the last hour, Humankind, a Hopeful History, an argument that we are fundamentally decent, mostly, and that more recognition of this view would likely be beneficial to everyone. I'd forgotten that. I didn't realise it was going to come after a phone-in in which decency was on full display from every caller as we addressed what we would like to see Rachel Reeves announce more money for a little later today, as opposed to your traditional media fare or radio phone-in fare, certainly, which is why I shouldn't be on the hook for anything, because it's all going to scroungers and layabouts and disabled people in BMWs. And his more recent book, Moral Ambition, I think the paperback is out in January, but that's well worth a read as well, and we'll probably sit down and have a longer chat then. If you don't know what the Streisand effect is, and I didn't until relatively recently, I just thought it was people who kept announcing comebacks, like the final chance to see. I don't know why I came up with that in reference to Barbara Streisand. It's not even something I associate particularly with her, but I thought that was the Streisand effect. Claim that this is your farewell tour and you'll sell a lot more tickets than you would if people knew you'd be on tour again in a couple of years. That is not the Streisand effect. The Streisand effect is when you complain about something and end up drawing way, 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 way more attention to that thing you're complaining about than it would have received if you hadn't complained about it. And it's about a beach house that she had and an American, I don't even know if it was a newspaper, I think it was just a website that was not very popular at the time, that published a photograph of her beach house, and she went to such epic legal and PR lengths to get the photo removed that it ended up being seen by millions and millions of people, more than would ever have seen it if she'd just stayed quiet and sucked it up in the first place. So that's the Streisand effect, and that's what the BBC have probably done by removing a line from a Reith lecture. But you can hear Bertrand Russell turning in his urn, spinning in his grave at the very thought of that. In fact, you can hear, is it Alexander Reith? I always get his first name wrong. It's lost in my memory, but you can hear Lord Reith. There you go. That's one advantage of a peerage, is that if you can't remember somebody's Christian name, you can just call him Lord. Lord Reith also spinning in his grave at the thought of a Reith lecture being censored by cowardly board members over at the BBC, which is almost certainly what has happened. Okay. What has been the personal experience I had in 2025 that I have mentioned most often on the radio? Anybody? Anybody? Bueller? The thing that happened to me this year, and it, remember, that means we're going all the way back to the beginning of January, that I have mentioned more than anything else that has happened to me this year on the radio. Can you think, what would it be? Let's, John Reith, thank you, thank you. I like the crowd-sourcing nature of this program. That's not the answer to the question I just asked. It's the answer to the question that I asked before the question that I just asked. The question that I just asked was, what personal experience of mine this year have I referenced more often than anything else on the program? Matt and Dave have already got it right. Julian has got it right. Specifically though, lads, not just what I was doing when I had that personal experience, but what the personal experience was. Claire has got it right. The personal experience I had that informed my opinion about lots of things and sort of stripped some scales from my eyes in other ways. Phil's got it right. Norman's got it right. Glenn's got it right. No, Glenn hasn't got it right. It's not playing tennis, you cheeky man. How dare you? Yes. Well, God, bing, 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 bing. Can we have a sound effect, Keith, please, for everybody coming in with the correct answer? Bing, 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 bing. If you're just tuning in, don't worry, I'm fine. It's budget day. So exciting. It was the lady, the woman, at Isleworth Crown Court, who was on jury service like me, and who spoke. And what I found so extraordinary about it was the casualness of her delivery, just the way in which she completely... she didn't think she was saying anything out of the ordinary. She thought she was treating people to an insight into a secret. She sort of thought, but it didn't cross her mind that the secret wasn't true. I mean, that was the thing that struck me. I'm sitting at a table adjacent. Have I given you the full details on this? So it was her first day. And we'd been there a week. So it was the Monday of the second week. So we've got our sort of friendships going on and our little seating groups. And she saw, or someone at the next table to me, saw someone that he used to work with 10 years ago. And so he called her over and they had a nice hello and she sat down. And so what she's done is she's arrived at a table where the social interaction had already been established. I think, if memory serves, they were all on the same jury, but there was a seat at their table. So she sits down with people who have not only spent a week together, they've spent a week together on jury service. And she sits down with them, and about 10 minutes into the conversation, she does a little bit of catching up with the bloke she used to work with. And then there's a little bit of chatter, and then they explain to her they can't really talk about what's going on in the jury room. And so then I'm zoning out because I'm having my own conversation at the next table and checking my phone, probably. And then my ears prick up, and she is explaining to these people that she's only just met in completely matter-of-fact tones. That's the point. The most matter-of-fact tones. It was as if she was discussing the weather. She just said, oh, and of course Michelle Obama is a man. And this is the point at which my ears pricked up. And my inner voice went, don't get involved, James. Don't get involved, James. Don't get involved, James. Don't get involved, James. So just sit and listen. Oh, yes, of course Michelle Obama is a man. And I sort of tried to strain to hear a little bit more, and somebody else spoke. Really? Good Lord. And then the next thing I heard from her was, and of course, you know, all the money that's being sent to Ukraine, Zelensky's spending it all on yachts, but don't worry, Trump is going to sort everything out. And I know I stress this point. It was the matter of factness of her delivery, the way that she wasn't just suggesting, she wasn't just sharing something she'd heard. She was sharing something that she was absolutely 150% convinced of, even though it was obviously bonkers. Michelle Obama is a man, and Volodymyr Zelensky has spent all the money sent to Ukraine on three of the biggest yachts in the world. And you know how she knew this was true? Because she had pictures of the yachts on her phone that she then shared with everybody else sitting at the table. And she was on a jury. Now, that shouldn't influence my response to news today that trial by jury is to be scrapped for most crimes. Or should it? I honestly don't know. But I do know that I don't think that I want it to be too big a weight on the scale. You know when something happens and you can't measure the influence it has on you, but you're not sure the influence is healthy. Before this happened, what would I have thought about trial by jury? Before I did my jury service and encountered one of the most frighteningly ignorant people. And remember what I do for a living. Think back to some of the calls we took in the immediate aftermath of Brexit or when Trump was on his first lap of honour. One of the most frighteningly ignorant people I have ever met. And I've interviewed Nigel Farage. What would my thoughts on jury service have been before that experience? Would I today have been shocked to see the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, apparently planning to abolish trial by jury for all but the most serious crimes? I just don't know. And that's not the phone-in, is it? Because that would just be weird. But I'm just putting it out there in case I hit sort of 12:45. No, it's going to be sort of 10 to 12 today, 5 to 12 when Natasha joins us to tee up PMQs. If I have undertaken an enormous reverse ferret, if I've completely retreated from the position that I'm about to expound, then I think it will be her fault. Because I'm supremely untroubled by this. The only reservation I've got is that it may not actually solve the backlog problems that are blighting our criminal justice system. I can't quite work out what I'm supposed to be outraged by or worried about. The chair of the Criminal Bar Association says the erosion of the right to jury trial will break the increasingly thin connection between the state and ordinary people and risks undermining social cohesion. I love the connection between the state and ordinary people, and I really value social cohesion, but I'm not feeling what she is saying. And listen, let's get Lammy's hypocrisy up and front and centre immediately as well. 2020, he said, juries are a fundamental part of our democratic settlement. Criminal trials without juries are a bad idea. And the quibble I have that it won't actually make any difference to the backlogs is cited by the president of the Law Society of England and Wales, Mark Evans, who says we have not seen any real evidence that expanding the types of cases heard by a single judge will work to reduce the backlogs. And Kemi Badenoch said something as well. But why? Why is this a bad thing? Or of course, why is it a good thing? We need to go to the ads on time because it's budget day, which means all the schedules are tight. And it means I probably shouldn't have done a sort of 5 or 6 minute flight of fancy at the top of this hour. I should have cut straight into the heart of things. Because Aggie Chambray is standing in front of a lamppost outside Downing Street and we need to cross live to her at the very first opportunity. But for no obvious reason, she'll just shout a question at Rachel Reeves, which Rachel Reeves doesn't answer, because that's what all the political correspondents have to do today. It's in their contracts, it's actually the law, and if they don't do it, they'll be in court this time next week, although possibly not with a jury. So, they're getting rid of trial by jury for all but the more serious cases. What do you think about that? 0345 6060973. This is one of those opportunities to tell me I'm an idiot. I'm untroubled by this. Give me a ring. Tell me why I'm an idiot.
This is LBC.
2 Costa Lattes for Abby.
The family calendar's already overflowing. Christmas parties, visiting the in-laws, and endless wrapping. But here, in this Costa Coffee date, everything slows. Just a pair of hands held together and another holding mugs. You smile, promising to do this more before the season sweeps you away again. It's more than a latte. It's a Costa Christmas catch-up. Costa Coffee, made with heart.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of J.P. Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search J.P. Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Get gifting sorted with Black Friday deals on the UK's best network.
I need a present for my bro.
How about saving £960 on the epic Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra on EE with generative edit?
So he can remove his ex from his photos?
Sure can. Plus, claim a Samsung Galaxy Tab S10 Lite worth £329 too.
Nice, a little something for me.
Offer ends 4th December.
Savings across contract, eligibility, credit check and terms apply. Credit by EE Limited. Claim from Samsung within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply. Verify best network at ee.co.uk/claims.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It's only in the context of jury service being abolished in most cases that I'm encouraging you to ring me and tell me why I'm an idiot, all right? You can't just ring in with a whole list of other reasons. It's specifically on the jury service being abolished and me thinking that's not really a very big deal. I kind of know I'm an idiot, but I don't know why, and I need you to tell me. You can also, of course, ring me and tell me why you agree. Perhaps because of your experiences doing jury service. So that's what we're doing as a phone-in, 03456060973. But I am contractually obliged now to cross live to Downing Street, where our political correspondent, Aggie Chambray, is holding a microphone.
Good morning, James. Rachel Rees, the Chancellor, is about to come out of number 11 Downing Street, where, as you point out, I am standing right outside. This morning, she has already held the cabinet meeting with the Prime Minister, where they've gone through that budget, her second massive budget, signed it off. The Prime Minister has left for Prime Minister's questions a few minutes ago. And Rachel Rees, the Chancellor, we are all waiting, the entire British press pack, waiting in Downing Street for her to come out so we can all shout a question at her and see that brilliant image of her holding up that iconic red box. And this is a massive moment, not just the red box, although that
hang
is
on, I'm just ticking. I'm just ticking iconic. Well done, we've got iconic. Carry on, Aggie.
Thank you, perfect. It's a massive moment because it's her second budget, but if her critics would be believed, it could also be her last budget. And there are so many audiences for this budget too. She keeps on saying it's a cost of living budget. She's taking the tough decisions for it to tackle cost of living. And I think those words are really for the Parliamentary Labour Party, a sort of Parliamentary Labour Party facing budget. And I don't think that's necessarily what we expected, but there's been so many leaks, briefings, U-turns. You remember the income tax? We all thought income tax was going to rise for a couple of weeks because Rachel Reeves did that speech, that iconic speech, where she basically strongly implied it was going to rise. And then basically the FT said it wasn't, and now it seems like it's not going to happen. So instead there's going to be this smorgasbord of tax rises. Why isn't it happening? Well, it seemed like Labour MPs were basically just too concerned about there being a break in the manifesto pledge. That was, of course, one of the things she did during the manifesto to sort of box herself in, really. And she said at the time it would be a nice problem to have. Well, it's a pretty big problem to have now. So it's a PLP facing budget. Well, what does that mean? It means she's going to do several things, like we think she's going to lift the two-child benefit cap, something that is deeply popular with Labour MPs and actually not popular with the country. She's also going to raise the minimum wage again. Very, very popular with Labour MPs, not popular with business, who are the other audience of this budget, who she, I think, should be concerned about too. The other things we know, she's going to keep the triple lock. Again, popular with the party, not necessarily popular with the country. And one of the big ticket items that we think is going to happen, we expect to happen, is to freeze income tax threshold, something she said she wasn't going to do. Again, actually unpopular with the country, but popular with the markets, her other big audience for this absolutely huge budget.
So
I'm just waiting, James.
I know you are. And I mean, if you keep asking yourself questions like this and answering them, Aggie, I'm not going to be able to get a word in edgeways. Now I know what it's like to be a caller to this programme. So, I mean, you're doing two things at once. You're not only talking, but you're also looking repeatedly over your shoulder to see if the Chancellor is coming out of the House. Any thoughts on what question you might shout at her in certain knowledge that she won't answer it?
Absolute certain knowledge that she won't answer it. I think I'll probably ask whether this is a budget about her own survival and whether she thinks it will be her last. I suppose the advantage of getting to ask a question that she won't answer is you can ask quite a rude question.
Yes.
So there sort of isn't really an answer to. She probably doesn't know whether or not this will be her last budget, but I can ask her anyway.
That's a mystery hour answer, Aggie, that you've just provided, because people have rung in to ask, why do journalists always shout at politicians coming out of Downing Street even though they never get an answer? And the point is, the question is the point, not the answer. You could shout, have you had your Weetabix, Chancellor?
It's a great question, yeah. Well, she would never answer it. I think the sort of the original reason for those shouts is sort of a TV thing, isn't
yes,
it?
Of course.
Because she comes out and you use it at the beginning of a TV package. But now it's such a thing that we do it on radio too, and it's, you know, it's a moment, and it sort of is supposed to encapsulate what the budget is about. And I think encapsulating who this is for, whether it's actually about her own survival and whether this will be her last, are kind of the key questions about today, really.
And although even more guaranteed than usual that she won't answer any of them. And you mentioned TV, of course. The television station is currently focusing on a door that is currently closed. That is the big news of the moment as we await Rachel Reeves' emergence from said door. The television companies are united in their determination to focus the cameras on that door. And there's Aggie again, just moving into our shop. Because although this is nominally a radio station, this is the 21st century, and you can watch a lot of this, should you so desire, on the LBC app, on Global Player. In fact, you can watch PMQs and the budget in its entirety on the LBC app, and indeed on Global Player. PMQs and the budget live and in full on the new LBC app. Sheila Fogarty will be joining you after that. It's all streamed live with all the reaction. And she's let us down, Aggie. I've got to get on with the programme. It's 24 minutes after 11, give or take a few seconds, and the Chancellor still hasn't appeared.
What does that say about her? It's not great, is it? We were promised 11:20.
Maybe she's changing her mind. Aggie, we're gonna work out what it would sound like for you to describe her coming out through the door. But if you could just shout your question for the listeners, even though the Chancellor's not there yet, could you do that, or would you be too embarrassed doing it in front of all your colleagues?
Yeah. I wouldn't be embarrassed at all, James. I would do it. I'd do it for you.
Go on then.
Is this budget about your own survival? Will it be your last?
Thank you. We can edit that and make it sound like you did it while she was actually within earshot. Aggie Chambray live for LBC from just by the door. We'll keep Aggie there for you. But in the meantime, we're taking a call on why I'm an idiot. David, why am I an idiot?
Well, I've been a juror. I've been called up twice.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know, but you go for 2 weeks. I went to your local court at Brentford.
I was in Isleworth. I didn't go to my local. How did you? Crikey, I didn't get on a single case. You got on six, it says here.
I got on six.
That's outrageous. Yeah. I came home without having been on one. Anyway, go on, carry on. Does it give you faith in jury service or not?
The jury service was absolutely brilliant.
Okay.
And the judges were immensely good.
Okay.
Very, very, very learned and clever. But I don't know if you know, there's a big room with about 150 people in. There's 12 courts that can sit at any one time. So they need to have jurors ready to get 12 people in to listen to a case.
No, I know all that. I have done it. I did it in Isleworth in February. Let me nudge you if I may. Sorry if I sound a bit brusque, but I've got to keep one eye. The door is opening! The door is opening, David!
The door is opening. Rachel Reeves is standing outside number 11 Downing Street. She's walked out with that iconic red box. She's standing amongst her Treasury ministers. We have Dan Tomlinson. She's standing forward next to James Murray. Torsten Bell there too, of course. And she's showing the world's media that iconic red box. Now, of course, it is not the same red box as it was when it was first made. That was in 1860 for William Gladstone. That is not the same red box as that. Now, I'm just going to do my shout here, James.
Come on.
Chancellor, is this budget about your own survival? Will it be your last?
I think she flinched. She flinched.
That's almost her answering, James.
She flinched. I swear she flinched. Well, actually, there's probably a delay. She's probably flinching at someone else. But anyway.
No, I think she did flinch.
I think she flinched. Well done, Aggie. You've got to flinch. Live flinch. Live on LBC. Brilliant. Live on the app if you're watching. She looks lovely. I know that's not probably, I wouldn't say that about Philip Hammond, so it might be sort of borderline misogynistic, but she does look lovely. I love that outfit.
It's a good outfit. I think it's a fair enough thing to say when it's a very cool suit.
And did they arrange themselves in... she's now walking. Jeremy Hunt looked very robotic at this point in proceedings. I'm delighted to report that Rachel Reeves does not. Did they arrange themselves in height order there?
She doesn't look robotic. She's not smiling.
No, well, you wouldn't, would you? I mean, not with that level of questioning that she's just been exposed to, Aggie. You've just ruined her day. You've just ruined her day. And she's off in a car. The door is closed. The car has
driving
gone.
Driving off...
That's it now. Are you clocking off for the rest of the day, Aggie?
I'll pop in later just to check everything's okay, but I think my job here is done. I made the Chancellor flinch.
You did indeed. Well done. A live flinch there. A world exclusive, sort of. on LBC. Back to David. Do you agree with David Lammy that we should get rid of juries for all but the most serious cases?
Broadly, yes.
Oh.
So the six cases I sat on,
yes.
One needed a jury trial. It was complicated and quite long. The other five were open and shut cases, absolutely guilty, no question. All the evidence was there,
yeah.
Video evidence, testimony from decent people, from police officers. One was a GBH, one yeah. was signing a check at a building society, which was a fraud. One was carrying a knife. It was all open and shut, and why they'd come to jury baffles me.
Because they're entitled to, I suppose.
I know, but this is the thing. So it comes to jury, we pay all these 12 people to be off work for 2 weeks. We sat in the jury room, and it was minutes it took us. We'd come back to the jury room, all the evidence, right, let's look at the video one more time. Okay, who says guilty? We all say guilty, ring the bell, we're back in front of the court. In minutes, James. And
no, I hear you, and this is compelling, but the system exists for the cases that aren't like the ones you're describing, doesn't it? And you can't really ensure that someone who we might agree deserves a trial by jury is going to get it unless lots of people who we wouldn't agree need a trial by jury don't get it. Get it.
So we need systems and checks in place. So perhaps if two magistrates at the magistrates' court, which had referred them to the, I think it's county
yeah.
court, maybe if there was a panel, these three magistrates could, if they didn't agree, if it's not unanimous, send it up. If they all agree, look, here's the video evidence, here's the police officer's testimony.
Serious cases, it wouldn't apply, but much easier to nobble one judge than it would be to nobble 12 jurors. Just from a quibbling point of view. I've been playing a mafia video game.
Yeah, but a GBH in a nightclub where a guy headbutts someone,
yeah.
who's going to nobble a jury? Who's going to nobble three magistrates or whatever?
Well, it depends who administered the headbutt. I'm not being facetious. Obviously, if it was like a major local gangster with loads of money and connections, then they could. But anyway, these are possibly cases that would anyway demand a jury service. Right, so I'm not an idiot then. Well, at least, David, to be clear, on this particular issue, you don't think I'm an idiot.
I don't think you're an idiot, but I think they could brush up and save a lot of time. And also, these jury cases take months to come to trial from the magistrate's court. They could be done and dusted.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, but I also think we might be missing something, because some of the people I admire most in general, let alone just in the legal world, are united in their opposition to this. And I don't think that there is a case for saying, well, they would be, wouldn't they? Because, you know, if you're a barrister, you're still going to have to convince the judge. You're still going to make, I guess, I reckon if I was a barrister, I'd fancy my chances more with a jury than I would with a judge. And I think the feeling, if not the statistics, which would be hard to measure anyway, is that juries are more likely to acquit than judges are, which reduces the likelihood of a miscarriage of justice, i.e. someone being locked up who is innocent. But I can't see what everyone's getting so worked up about. 11:30 is the time, and Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The Chancellor has just left Downing Street to make her way to the Commons to deliver her budget. Rachel Reeves is promising fair and necessary choices, which are widely expected to include a freeze of the income tax threshold. The policy would drag more people into a higher tax band as their earnings grow. Ms Reeves is understood to be ready to also scrap the two-child benefit cap after pressure from Labour MPs and charities. A wealth or mansion tax could also be announced. You can hear the budget live and in full here on LBC from 12:30, and then join Sheila Fogarty for all the reaction and analysis. In other news this morning, local media reports in Hong Kong say four people have died in a high-rise building fire. Online footage shows flames and smoke engulfing the building in the Tai Po district. And some breaking news, we're hearing Paul Doyle has pleaded guilty to charges over a car being driven into crowds during Liverpool's Premier League victory parade in May. We'll bring you more on that story in our news bulletins this afternoon. LBC weather, sunny spells for southern and eastern areas today. Some rain will spread eastwards later, a high of 12 degrees.
This is LBC.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friends, if it's peak mating season, for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an E sound from Aerialo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction.
We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high. And low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 11:34. PMQ's on the way at 12, and the budget live on LBC from 12:30. Don't forget, you can watch it on the LBC app. I don't know. I don't think this is unfair. All right, who would you rather go for a drink with? You may have heard me mention a moment ago when I was talking about nobbling jewelries that I'm currently playing a video game that is based in the world of the mafia. It's based in early 20th century Sicily. And who would you rather go for a drink with? Colin and, I beg your pardon, Neil, who writes, which video game, James? Peter, who writes, what game is it, James? Or Gareth, who writes, James, you don't do yourself any favours by admitting to playing video games. Grow up. Which, I think, demands that we click the history button, doesn't it? We have to see what else prompts Gareth to get in touch with LBC. You don't do yourself any favours by admitting to playing video games. Grow up is the most recent. Here is the one before. No wonder you're overweight. I'm just not going to tell you what time that was sent. To spare blushes. Possibly my own, possibly a colleague's. No wonder you're overweight. All food-obsessed people like yourself appear to be. You're a barrel of laughs, aren't you? I don't think Nick will mind me reading out this one in its entirety. Nick, please stop all this constant and sickening fawning over the royals. Nobody gives a monkey's. And then the previous day, a week previously, who gives a monkey's what a footballer thinks? He's only a footballer. This one, not on my watch. I think you should change the subject. This is boring and irrelevant. And what kind of stuff does Gareth? There's another one. This is from the 29th of September. This is so boring. What does Gareth find interesting? If everything that he sends into the programme is boring. Oh, here we are. This guy is wrong. Beech hedges retain all their leaves until the new ones appear. That's the kind of content Gareth is here for. Can we do, Keith, write this down. Can we do more on beech hedges tomorrow? Because Gareth is finding everything else that we do boring. Oh, and here's another one. Furthermore, writes Gareth, you need to get your information right. If you can prove good reason for owning a blank firing gun, it is not illegal to own an unconverted top venting gun. So guns and beech hedges, but not sport or the royals. There's a marketing opportunity there, but I can't quite work out what it is. I wonder what he thinks about juries, but we know what he thinks about video games. Colin deserves a little pat on the back for this one. He goes, the jury's out on whether or not you're an idiot. Thank you. David is in Bromley. What did we think, David?
Hiya, James.
Hello, David.
I think you're sane, actually.
Thank you very much.
You're the voice of reason in this unreasonable world. I think we should keep juries. They've got a long history, you know, and a lot of the
world...
Well, so did.
I mean, I'm going to go... Would you mind if I reach for a slightly unhelpful cliche at this point?
Please, sir.
Well, sending children up chimneys had a long history as well, but it was still the right thing to abolish it.
Ah, yes. But the rest of the world's legal system is by and large based on ours.
Yes.
So, you know, there must be something right there for the rest of the world to follow us in large.
Well, that, I need a bit more than that. I need a bit more than why do we do it? Because we do and we always have. Why do we like juries? Why is a jury trial better than a judge or a panel of judges?
So, as you rightly said, and your other callers said, James, you get these imbeciles that say Michelle Obama.
Yeah, on the jury.
Yeah, on the jury. But she is a person of reasonable standing in you know, a jury of your peers. So
yeah, so she'd presumably be closed down by the other 11, wouldn't she, you'd think?
Exactly. No, absolutely, mate. You know,
what's your perspective on it?
Have 9 or 10 reasonable people in there that will shut them up.
Any professional or personal experience?
Yeah, I was a police officer with the Met for years and years. And, you know, it's very hard to remain impartial on things, especially when you see people being done over by other people.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, any magistrate or judge sitting alone is going to have feelings. It's impossible not to if you're human, you know.
So a jury has a leavening factor built into it. It has a leavening. The extremes get leavened, whereas a judge who is tempted towards an extreme has no hand on his shoulder slowing him down or cautioning him.
No, absolutely. And I think the backlog could definitely be dealt with by changes in the system, you know, perhaps reducing the number of cases that go to court, you know, dealing with them either through the police, through fixed penalty notices or community resolutions, things like that. And, you know,
I suppose if it doesn't reduce the backlog, then we could sit here and wonder why they bothered doing it in the first place. But if it does, then some of your concerns might be assuaged. You might think, actually, that probably was a price worth paying. Do you know what the backlog is at the moment?
It's something like 80,000, isn't it?
Mate, Keith, get the round of applause ready. How did you do that? Have you been reading the news?
I listen to you every day.
That's outstanding. 80,000 cases, the backlog. But, of course, we don't know until they try it whether or not this takes a significant chunk out of them. Go on, sorry.
No, sorry. I just wonder, in this climate where we seem to be unable to make decisions, whether by the time we've implemented it, that we're then immediately regretting that it doesn't work and, you know, spending more money going back to what we had originally.
Yeah, well, that is that oddly, the big things they do seem to sometimes be the sort of finance-free ones. I mean, I appreciate this will save a little bit of money, although I don't know how much. Jurors get expenses. They don't get a fee. It's a relatively, well, it depends how much you earn, but it's unlikely to match your wages. Well, it doesn't match your wages. But the only benefit would be a massive reduction in that 80,000 backlog, and quite a lot of clever people are queuing up to say that wouldn't happen anyway. I'm more interested in the philosophy of it, the morality and the history that David has just very neatly reminded us of. What are we going to lose in intangible terms if we lose trial by jury? I don't know that this is very responsible broadcasting, but it's very authentic. If you're a massive criminal, what would you rather have? A judge or a jury? Seriously, I mean, I don't want to speak to really nasty people, not until we get back onto Brexit. But if you are, like, quite tasty, to use the parlance of 1970s cop shows, then what would you rather have, a judge or a jury? I'm unlikely to get any answers to that question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. 0345 6060973 is the number you need. Nick's in Crete. Nick, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
Hello.
I'd just like to make the point. First of all, I'll tell you, I'm 76 years of age.
Right? Okay, thank you for that. I'm 53.
You're just a boy. I started work 60 years ago, in the mid-60s.
Yes.
The first job I had, I won't go into who it was with, but there was an office of about 12 people. At that time, near enough, there was the famous Moore's murders of the kids.
Yes, yeah? Myra Hindley and Ian Brady.
Exactly, exactly.
My dad covered that case.
One of our guys was called up to be on the jury.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And off he went, and he was got over. I can't remember if it was a month, 6 months, or whatever. He was away a long, long time.
Yeah.
Anyway, when he came back, he was a different man. He had to listen to all that.
I didn't know where you were going with this, but he had to listen to descriptions of children being murdered in the most hideous circumstances.
Exactly. And he was a changed man. He was about, well, I mean, I was, what, 16 at the time. He was, remember, about 45 or something.
Yeah.
But it was a different bloke. So I'm all for the abolishing of trial by jury, but not for the reasons that have been spoken about, but for the reason that this can happen, right?
I mean, the detail would be available to the general public if they were so minded to you can follow the cases now in and I think then you glossed over quite an interesting part of this actually when I mentioned to you that my late father covered those trials, so my dad would have heard everything that the juror heard.
Well, all I remember is my reaction to seeing that was his name.
Well, that's your empathy, that's your compassion, isn't it? You worry. And did he stay changed? Was he sort of quietened by the experience?
I worked there until 1970, so I was there for 5 years.
Right.
I've forgotten exactly what years.
Don't worry, mate, it's fine. I hadn't thought of that, but I think that is Magna Carta territory, is that the public do sit in judgment on what another member of the public has done, and they can't do that unless they know exactly what they've done. But I like that. It's another example of something that doesn't immediately present itself. Whereabouts in Crete are you?
I'm in a place, of course, you know the area.
Well, I don't know Crete very, very well. I know bits of Crete, but I've been to Heraklion, obviously, and Chania.
Chania, that's where I am.
Oh, wow, you lucky man.
Oh, I tell you what, mate, I love it. And the weather at the moment.
Yeah, all right.
I won't tell you.
Here's a funny one, and I've got no reason to doubt Steve in Chester. He says, my granddad was on the same jury as Nick's colleague, and I disagree with Nick.
Really?
So, there you go, all human life is here. I mean, it wouldn't be incredible if we could find a link to all 12 jurors listening to the programme today, albeit that it would be, by dint of how old they'd have to have been at the time, probably a second-hand link. Nick, take care. Kalo taxi di filosmu. It is coming up to 11:45. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC.
The Budget. Have your say only on LBC.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
Black Friday is non-stop. Orders, calls, messages.
Sounds like you need the right sidekick to keep business booming, Claire.
Go on.
In EE's Black Friday sale, you can save £720 on a 36-month plan with the Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra. Perfect for keeping your business running smoothly.
What a deal. Thanks, Kev.
Search EE Business today. BT and EE. Better for business.
Excludes 20% VAT. Ends 4th of December. Terms apply.
Gift more for less when you shop at the O2 this Christmas. Save up to 70% off RRP on over 60 of their favorite designer brands, including Nike, Tommy Hilfiger, Le Creuset, the cosmetics company store, and Lindt. Ticked everyone off your list. Start the festivities at one of our 30 bars and restaurants. Enjoy a movie or get competitive with bowling, climbing, interactive football, indoor skydiving, and more. Find us at North Greenwich, just 15 minutes from central London. Search outlet shopping at the O2 to start planning your visit.
With Lloyd's Home Insurance, there's £50,000 to be won. When you cover the glassware no one's actually allowed to use, or the garden shed, aka your fortress of calm. Rated excellent on Trustpilot, you can be confident with your cover when you take out a new home insurance policy and be in for a chance to win £50,000. Get a quote with Lloyd's today. Buy a new home insurance policy direct from us by the 31st of December 2025. Offer T's and C's apply. Policy terms, limits and exclusions apply.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
squealed me a mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use,
interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with three tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
11:47 is the time. Just a little bit of clairvoyance for you. Rachel Reeves will get mocked or insulted tomorrow, including by misogynists who describe her as Rachel from Accounts, because she is going to use her budget speech today to, in part, explain the lasting and enormous damage that Brexit has done to our economy. That's a matter of historical record. And I just want you to bear that in mind, because a week ago, a Conservative Prime Minister and election winner gave a speech at the LSE, which in normal circumstances would have been picked up by His Majesty's media, but because he also understands the reality of what was done to this country in 2016 by people like Michael Gove and Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg and Nadine Dorries and countless members of my profession, including several LBC presenters, the simple and stark reality of the economic damage done to our country by Brexit is the biggest elephant in the history of elephants in any rooms ever. And here is some absolutely heartbreaking proof of that point.
Brexit is a flop. It will not leap up from its deathbed. It is losing our country. Pause for a moment. It is losing our country 100 billion, billion, not million, 100 billion pounds of trade every year, as well as the tax revenue that that trade would deliver to the British Exchequer. Just think about that. Every year, the loss of billions of European trade is damaging our finances. The loss is made far greater by some decisions the present government has taken. And that is one reason why we are facing a painful and difficult budget later this month. Serious economists forecast, and it is a forecast, so it may not be accurate, but serious economists almost universally agree that there will be a cumulative loss to the economy of £311 billion by 2035, together with 3 million fewer jobs and a fall in trade levels with the European Union. As of now, this matter of fact, not conjecture, many small and medium-sized firms have simply been defeated by post-Brexit bureaucracy and simply find it no longer profitable to trade with Europe. It is baffling that at a basic minimum, we are not now looking at how to negotiate away such frustrations created by bureaucracy.
And he, of course, is a Conservative talking about a Labour government. Dropping facts. The last forecasts were found not to have gone far enough. So when he acknowledges the fact that they are fallible, he possibly leaves himself open to misinterpretation, because it could be that the reality turns out to be worse than the forecasts. £311 billion, 3 million jobs, £100 billion worth of trade a year lost as a consequence of listening to people like Farage, Johnson, Rees-Mogg and Gove. And now Rachel Reeves will, and I'll tell you something for nothing, all right? The Venn diagram of people who will describe Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, as Rachel from Accounts and mock her for explaining the role that Brexit has made or played in creating this fiscal crisis. The Venn diagram of people in that category and people who, for personal or professional reasons, told you to vote for Brexit is a circle. It's not a Venn diagram, it's a circle. Well, it is a Venn diagram, but but both sides intersect so much that they end up being the same circle. So listen for it tomorrow. People saying Rachel from Accounts, people mocking her for mentioning the reality of Brexit, people who claim to be Conservatives but will completely ignore, have already completely ignored what Sir John Major, for anyone who didn't recognise his very distinctive tones, Sir John Major has just laid out in irrefutable fashion the level of dishonesty that you need now to both ignore John Major and ignore the impact of Brexit is absolutely spectacular. And yet it's so commonplace. What a bonkers country this is, where one of the biggest, if not the absolute biggest reason why we are in such parlous economic condition is glossed over by 99% of the media and 99% of the political establishment. Yeah, and you're right, that makes us the 1%. Back to jury service. Scott is in Manchester. Is David Lammy right, or is he playing with fire, Scott?
Playing with fire, James.
Tell me more.
Well, obviously, you've already mentioned the fact that he was dead against removal.
That is hypocritical and therefore troubling. But I want to know why you think it's the wrong idea.
Yeah, it's the wrong idea because it will not reduce the backlog that we're currently facing at the moment. Mm. If you or anybody else thinks that by increasing or changing the current legal system will then streamline or curtail the backlog or reduce it, it's complete ludicrousy because we still do not have the infrastructure to manage that backlog regardless. We do not have enough judges. We do not have enough court staff. We do not have enough transportation services to get the detainees from prison to court at all. The backlog is caused by court inefficiencies due to lack of staffing, inexperience, and probably other reasons that I'm not privy to.
No, I hear you. And I could push back a little bit and say, well, if you've got the rigmarole of finding, swearing in, and then the deliberations, days of deliberations when a judge could presumably arrive at a conclusion much quicker, then there is some reason to believe that things might move a little bit quicker. But those arguments address none of the systemic problems that you've described. Can you move into the philosophy of it? I sense you're a solicitor or a barrister, why it's valuable to have juries.
Well, you know, the principle of having a jury services to ensure that the innocent are judged by their peers. Mm. And you need those people from all walks of life to live, breathe and understand that particular defendant at the time, to look at the evidence at the time. At the Crown Court, the jury are removed from legal arguments in relation to all elements of evidence that may be admissible or inadmissible. There are legal arguments that the jury are never privy to.
Yes.
And therefore, they judge the evidence based solely on the evidence. And it's the judge's job to ensure that evidence that is admissible is allowed in, and obviously evidence that isn't. So they're literally seeing the script as it should be. They're not seeing draft one, draft two, draft three. They are seeing the final script.
Yes.
And when one of the previous callers mentioned bias, and obviously magistrates and judge, even then, under their subconscious, they could have a bias based on the evidence they're supposedly not to be relying on.
I hadn't thought of that. So it's asking a heck of a lot of judges, actually, in that context, because
correct,
they need to both be party to everything and leave some of the stuff that they know out of their deliberation somehow.
Absolutely.
I honestly hadn't thought of that. And, you know, obviously, in the cases that are still going to have juries, that dichotomy is going to be a lot deeper. But still, there'll be some cases that you and I could come up with where it would be pertinent, you know, lower level crimes of violence, that kind of thing.
No. So in principle, in the magistrates right now, if there is what's called a bad character evidence, where there's evidence of somebody repeatedly committing offences, whether that evidence should be brought into the trial or not, which is on a case by case basis, technically that application or that hearing should be heard by a different set of magistrates to the magistrate that will hear the trial. I don't really work in the magistrates. I've heard from colleagues that doesn't actually happen, and it should. And then you've got the infrastructure of how do you deal with that properly if there was to say, if Lammy or whoever was supposed to come back and say, well, actually, we can put something in place to make sure that somebody else hears the admissibility arguments of that separate, then it just increases and increases. The simple answer to this, James, is increase the funding across the board and stop messing with it. Do not move the deck chairs on the Titanic hoping for a different outcome. It's ridiculous.
Thank
and that
you.
Is separate. That is separate to the argument of Magna Carta, ethical, moral, and all that. That speaks for itself. But the actual implementation. I mean, think about it. If you put a new system in place, you're expecting this to go ahead without any teething problems.
No.
Do you not think that's going to cause extra delays?
Yeah, I mean, crikey, I'm glad you weren't the first caller. You knocked it out of the park. No, it's wonderful. I said you could carry on as well, but I'm not going to let you because we've got PMQs just around the corner, and I have to read a statement from the BBC. Here it is. James, please come back and present Newsnight. All is forgiven. Oh, that's not... No, that's not what it says. All of our programmes are required to comply with the BBC's editorial guidelines, and we made the decision to remove one sentence from the lecture on legal advice. You can listen back to my interview with the historian whose lecture was censored on Global Player, or indeed on the LBC app. Natasha Clark is here. No one cares about PMQs today, do they?
No, it's the most pointless.
All about the budget.
It's the most pointless PMQs of the year, isn't it?
And that's saying
why
something.
Bother?
That's saying something.
Well, last week we found it utterly boring, didn't we?
Yes.
Although maybe that was because we weren't listening properly.
giving it away like Toto the dog, honestly.
No, I think this, you know, it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, we're not going to be talking about this. We're not going to be talking about this tomorrow. No
well,
one's really going to remember.
Don't jinx it. Unless something extraordinary happens, like one of them resigns or something, or falls over. But no.
Unlikely.
So what's the chops do? Cammy Badenoch, what is she likely to do?
Obviously, you know, last week, obviously, she did sort of talk a little bit about the economy, and obviously she could talk about the budget ahead of it, but she's going to get an opportunity to do that for the rest of the day. So you'd like to think she would probably go on something else. The main sort of argument we've had in the last 24 hours is this big announcement, which was leaked, actually, by the Ministry of Justice about scrapping jury trials.
I wonder whether I think the Office of Budget Responsibility have accidentally published
and I was just trying to look at that on this.
But some of the people claiming this are not like, you know, fools. It looks as if they have accidentally published their reaction to the budget before the budget has actually been given. But hey ho, that's gossip, really, isn't it?
I guess so. But yesterday, obviously, or the day before yesterday, we had reports from the Office for Budget Responsibility, potentially leaks there, saying that they were about to downgrade their growth. So there's clearly a mole at the heart of the Treasury or the OBR that's leaking us all of the excitement a little bit early.
Indeedy doody. We still have to do your job, Natasha. You're still getting paid for this. So what is Cammy Badenoch likely to go in with today?
She was attacking jury trials yesterday. The government's proposals are to basically end jury trials for all but the most very serious offences. And lots of criticism from the Conservatives on this.
Just to clarify, it might be that the OBR is behaving perfectly normally and I just haven't paid attention in previous years.
They don't. I've just gone onto their website and it says we will be publishing our latest fiscal statement once the Chancellor has completed her budget statement in Parliament. That's absolutely not happened.
And they have now published their
latest. I can't see it on their website.
Maybe they haven't published it again. Maybe, but anyway, as I say, it's a sideshow. So what is Badenoch going to do?
Yeah, so jury trials, I think, might be one of those things that she's talking about. Another one which we've been covering on LBC today, another story, is about these Ajax fighting vehicles, which I was quite shocked to read this. The British Army forced to stop the use of Ajax armoured fighting vehicles after dozens of soldiers fell ill, the Times was reporting today. Quite a shocking story, and I'd actually thought that might be one that Cammy Badenoch could stick the boot in. I think she would be amiss not to at least mention the economy ahead of what is obviously going to be a very, very difficult budget for the Chancellor to deliver. She, you know, admitted earlier today, people, of course, are going to be very angry with her, and that she's got some really difficult choices to make. So you'd like to think that Cammy Badenoch will at least nod to what is a very difficult fiscal position and at least say, well, I'd be doing something very, very different if I were in charge.
Extraordinary to think how many audiences there are for this budget. We'll talk about that in a moment. But for the avoidance of doubt, the OBR have accidentally published their report early, which means that people could choose to spend the next half an hour completely ignoring PMQs and knowing exactly what Rachel Reeves is going to say from approximately 12:30 without having to wait for her to actually say it. But even with my slightly maverick approach to covering these live events, I don't think we're going to do that. We're still going to take the budget live and we're still going to pretend that we haven't had half an hour to read everything that is in it as a consequence of the OBR presumably accidentally pressing send. Worst day at work you've ever had? Not this one. What was it? Can you think of anything?
Nothing jumps to mind.
I once interviewed Paul Whitehouse of The Fast Show. And unfortunately, I'd had quite a good lunch before I arrived to do the interview, and I misunderstood something he'd told me. I took it back to the office, and I thought he'd complained about the Fast show not being on BBC One, and he hadn't. And we put it on the front page. I got a phone call from the news desk at 5 past midnight saying, we've just had a call from the BBC. This is just complete nonsense.
That's tough. I don't think I've ever had that. I think that whenever you get
the first edition,
whenever you get an IPSA complaint, as you know, that's a bad one, isn't it?
That's a blooding.
That's a bad one. Even if it no longer gets upheld later on, you still have a sinking feeling in your heart whenever somebody complains about you, don't you?
You sweet summer child. You don't have a sinking feeling at all. Means you're doing something right in some context.
Actually, I think when I think back to my worst day at work.
Anyway, I don't know who pressed send at the OBR, but they're going to be. They're not going to be sleeping well tonight. This is the point where I remind you that we will be crossing live to the House of Commons for one of the most eventful moments in the parliamentary calendar. But the budget, before that, we'll be crossing live the minute Kemi Badenoch gets to her feet and asks her first question to the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. And that moment is now.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I first pay tribute to the many farmers who have come to Westminster today? The shameful attack on them in last year's budget, I want them to know that Conservatives stand with them. Yeah. Mr. Speaker?
Yeah. They arrest them, we stand with them.
Mr. Speaker, this has been the most chaotic lead-up to a budget in living memory, with resignations, hostile briefings, and...
Can I just say to a couple of you, if you don't want the budget, make your mind up now.
Nobody wants this budget, Mr. Speaker. With resignations, hostile briefings and leaks galore, even just in the last 10 minutes, an unprecedented leak of the OBR analysis. Mr. Speaker, these leaks have been so serious that even the former chief economist of the Bank of England has said, and I quote, that Labour's fiscal fandango is the single biggest reason why growth has flatlined. Does the Prime Minister agree with Andy Haldane, and does he have an explanation for this complete shambles?
We all know the biggest shambles in living history, the Liz Truss budget. Did she say, I don't agree, this must be wrong? No, she said, I think Liz Truss is 100% right. 100%. Not much room for flexibility. Not one thing was wrong with it, in her view. So we won't be taking lectures from her. Matters for the OBR, the Chancellor will set out the budget in just a few minutes' time.
Mr. Speaker, we're talking about the leaks. The Prime Minister doesn't seem to appreciate the impact of these budget leaks on the UK economy. Even the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister has said this morning that the leaks were unacceptable. So will the Prime Minister launch an investigation into the budget leaks and punish those responsible?
Mr. Speaker, it's literally about 25 minutes before the budget will be set out in August, where we'll take further decisions. The Chancellor will set it out, but thanks to the decisions she's already taken, we've got 5 million extra NHS appointments, waiting lists are coming down, mortgages are cheaper, we've expanded free school meals, that's 100,000 children lifted out of poverty, a moral mission for this government. Compare that to the record opposite any day of the week.
Mr. Speaker, he talks about the decision she's already taken. If they were that great, we wouldn't have all those farmers outside protesting. He doesn't want to talk about leaks, but we can see that the chaos in Number 10 is having real-world consequences. Instead of focusing on the economy, they've been fighting like rats. Several journalists reported that Number 10 sources had briefed against the Health Secretary and other senior cabinet ministers. The Prime Minister then told us that these briefings did not come from Number 10. Will he repeat on the floor of the House the claim that none of his advisers has briefed against members of the Cabinet?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've been really clear about this. No one in Number 10 has briefed against Cabinet ministers. And the Health Secretary is doing a fantastic job. He stood before the electorate just before the last election. He said we'd deliver 2 million extra appointments for the NHS in the first year of a Labour government. There he is. What did he do? Not two, not three, not four, but 5 million extra appointments for the NHS. They don't understand this language, Mr. Speaker, because they left everything absolutely broken.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister expects us to believe him. No one does. We all know that he did not have a serious leak inquiry. What he did, Mr. Speaker, was he asked Morgan McSweeney to investigate Morgan McSweeney, and then Morgan McSweeney discovered that Morgan McSweeney was innocent. All of this calls into question the Prime Minister's judgment. All of this calls into question the Prime Minister's judgment. We read this weekend that he wants the former Deputy Prime Minister back in his cabinet. He must have forgotten that she had to resign only a few months ago for tax evasion. When did the Prime Minister decide that lawbreakers can be lawmakers?
Mr. Speaker, while she's scrolling through Twitter, we've delivered rail fares frozen, prescription charges frozen, the minimum wage boosted. We're focusing on the cost of living, the single most important thing for this country. She's focusing on tittle-tattle.
Jim Baynock.
It's not tittle-tattle, Mr. Speaker. We all know that he's only talking about welcoming the Deputy Prime Minister back because he is desperate to shore up his crumbling leadership. But if he were to welcome her back, will he set a condition that she must pay back the £40,000 of property taxes she avoided, the same property taxes they're very happy to put on everyone else, and will she also return her £17,000 of severance pay?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the former Deputy Prime Minister is the biggest social mobility story this country has ever told. She started from humble beginnings and fought her way to the very top. I'm very proud of what she's achieved in politics. I'm very proud of everything she's done for this Labour government.
That sounds like a no, Mr. Speaker. I've never heard the Prime Minister speak so highly of people avoiding their taxes. But in summary, this just looks like a government that is a slow-motion car crash. His cabinet are briefing against each other. His MPs are planning for life after him. And the most chaotic run-up to a budget in recent memory is happening on his watch. Even the Chief Whip is telling MPs that he wants out. The truth is simple, Mr. Speaker. His MPs don't trust him, the markets don't trust him, and the public certainly don't trust him. When will he finally accept that the chaos starts and ends with him?
The most chaotic budget was the Liz Truss budget. It did huge damage to our country. We're still suffering from that damage. But what did she say about Liz Truss? She obviously does still think it. When asked, was Liz Truss right? 100% right, she said. The most chaotic, damaging budget there's ever been. And she sticks by it. I'm very interested to see her response to this budget, if she thinks Liz Truss got it right. Mr. Speaker, what we're doing is focusing on cutting waiting lists, cutting the national debt, cutting the cost of living, renewing our country, a Labour budget with Labour values, delivering for the British people.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. At the moment, everyone is being bombarded with adverts and emails for Black Friday, encouraging them to spend money on so-called time-limited deals, leading to panic buying, increasing debt, buyer regret, and not to mention the impact on the planet, with delivery and returns of goods responsible for millions of tonnes of CO2 emissions. Does he agree with me that instead of rushing to buy online, people should look to their high streets to support local businesses and keep money in the local economy this Christmas?
Well, I want to see our high streets thriving, and I encourage everyone to support local businesses this Christmas. Through our small business strategy, we got £3 billion boost to help small businesses expand, and we've tackled the most significant reforms to tackle late payments, the most significant in 25 years, Mr. Speaker. And the Chancellor will have to say more about that in just a moment.
Trent David, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We've just seen in the leaked OBR documents that taxes are going up to a historic record high. So will the Prime Minister explain why Labour is hiking people's taxes instead of fixing the £90 billion Brexit black hole in the public finances by growing our economy with a new, detailed brilliant trade deal with our European partners.
Yeah. Well, he'll only have to wait a few minutes for the full details of the budget. But, Mr. Speaker, every week he comes here with the same problem. He always wants more spending, and he never wants to say how he's going to raise the money for it. The two things can't go together.
So, Ed Davey.
Speaker, we want to grow the economy, not tax the economy. But if I can take him on to another issue, Mr. Speaker, I hope everyone in the House shares my alarm that a former leader of a political party in Wales has been found guilty of betraying our country and has now been sentenced to over 10 years in prison for his treachery. The Prime Minister said that reform should hold an independent investigation, and he is right. But we both know that that's not going to happen. So given reform won't, he must. So will he now launch a national investigation into Russian infiltration into our politics?
Yeah. Well, he's right to highlight this very serious case. A long sentence for pro-Russian bribery in the Reform Party at the highest level. You would think a leader of a political party would want to get to the bottom of that and ask the question, how on earth did that happen in the Reform Party? And what other links are there between Reform and Russia? But no, the leader of Reform doesn't want to do it. Because, Mr. Speaker, we know he doesn't want to know the answer to the question because Reform is riddled with pro-Putin propaganda.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, after 8 years of traffic chaos and increasingly creative traffic diversions, residents of Parkside and Marston...
And there it is, an understandably brief PMQs, given that everybody in the House of Commons is probably on their phones looking at the budget that's been accidentally leaked by the Office for Budget Responsibility. Although, Ed Davey's second question there, one that should really be exercising a heck of a lot more interest in Westminster and beyond, the Russian propaganda parrots in Reform. One has been sent to jail, of course, for accepting money for doing it. The rest of them, presumably, as far as we currently know, did it for free. So why on earth wouldn't they want an inquiry? What is it they usually say, people like that, at times like this? If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. Anyway, I'll leave you with that thought. And we will return shortly to try to, well, we probably won't. We'll have a quick sort of lip service about what you've just heard with regard to PMQs. And then Natasha will tell you everything that's in the budget before Rachel Reeves stands up and tells you what is actually in the budget.
The budget. Have your say only on LBC.
Let's hear from the Chancellor, Geoffrey.
From the Chancellor, Nigel. Chancellor, John.
Norman.
Kenneth.
Gordon.
Alistair.
George.
Philip.
Sajid.
Rishi.
Nadine.
Kwasi.
Jeremy.
And now Rachel. Another year, another budget. Over the past 40 years, we've seen it all. Our experts will continue to filter through the noise and uncertainty, helping you make the most of your tax allowances. Hargreaves Lansdowne, helping Britain invest through it all. Capital at risk. Tax rules apply and can change.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
At Lathwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide, searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf, we don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaite's. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
With over 50 years' experience, at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools, and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions, or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It's 16 minutes after 12, and this does actually pose something of a professional problem for us, because we are providing lavish and comprehensive budget coverage from approximately 12:30 today. We'll take it live from the House of Commons, and then Sheila Fogarty and guests and colleagues will be going through the finer detail with the proverbial fine-tooth comb. But, and I don't think this has ever happened before, the whole thing is in the public domain already. We know exactly what is in it as a consequence of somebody at the Office of Budgetary Responsibility accidentally pressing send on their pre-prepared analysis of the budget. So we're operating in a sort of liminal space in broadcasting terms. We can't pretend it hasn't happened, but neither can we not carry on with the comprehensive and detailed coverage that we were planning to provide. So I'm just giving you a quick heads up, really, because it's incredibly uncharted territory. Shortly, we will start going through what is in it, even though we're not supposed to know what is in it yet, but we do. Before that, PMQs, as you predicted, Natasha, quite a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. Just one little thing struck me. If Angela Rayner does come back into the cabinet, the severance she receives as a consequence of having left the cabinet and lost the salary increase that is commensurate with that job. Lots of people in the shadow cabinet would have received severance payment before returning to frontline politics. Did any of them pay it back?
Of course they did not.
It's a bit disingenuous then, isn't
it? And of course we shouldn't forget that this Labour government has decided to change the rules around severance payments, meaning that in future government ministers should not receive such big payouts from the taxpayer. And yes, she has been in receipt of a nearly £17,000 severance payment check after leaving the government, which obviously many people will feel rightly upset about. Obviously, Andrew Rayner's got a big tax bill to pay. I'm sure it will just go straight towards that. Mm. But yes, you're completely right. This has been something which has overseen many a Tory minister. Whenever they are fired from the government or leave the government, they are entitled to severance payments of thousands of pounds. And you're totally right. It's one for every Tory that has taken.
Some of them had tiny tenures because they changed leadership and cabinet reshuffles so often.
Remember
so
Boris Johnson's last dying days? There were only some of them that were in place for a matter of hours. Was it Gillian Keegan that was in the Department for Education for about 72 hours? Pretty quick.
I don't know that she took any severance pay. I don't know that she didn't.
I don't know that she did or didn't, but I can tell you that a total of £933,000 was paid out in severance to ministers leaving the government in 2022-23, which is obviously the year that Boris Johnson stepped down. Yes, a lot of money.
Gosh, it surprises me how much it is. The leak is obviously huge.
This is pretty unprecedented.
Give us a bit of context, if you would, on how big a, quotes, story, end quotes, this is.
So, journalists, colleagues of mine in the lobby will remember the days where the Evening Standard accidentally published their front page. I can't remember exactly what year it was. Do you remember this, James? Where they published their... It was in the days where the Evening Standard had their front page come out around sort of 1 o'clock.
It was a resignation offence for anything to find its way into the public sphere. There's been leaks galore this year.
But this, leaking the actual measures from the budget is absolutely unprecedented. You know, you can understand that people in the Treasury are going to be absolutely furious that this sort of shambolic way that this has come about has been leaked, and all of the details of all of these tax
rises. Give us the plumbing details then.
Okay, I will. It's everything we already knew, James. Absolutely everything is what we already knew. Freezing personal tax and employer national insurance, charging national insurance on salary sacrificed pensions, increasing dividends, increasing property and savings income, new mile charges, new EV charges from April, gambling taxes, capital gains tax relief is changing. We've talked about this a lot in the last couple of days. A high value council tax surcharge, so on homes worth over £2 million, they will get an extra whack. This is, I think, the most interesting thing that I didn't know so far. Yeah. There will be a freeze to fuel duty for just 5 more months, and then fuel duty is going to go up for the first time in 15 years.
So pay per mileage.
Pay per mileage will eventually take over from fuel duty, of course, in terms of that tax take for the Chancellor. She's given herself plenty of fiscal headroom, according to the OBR documents that we're looking through, £22 billion in headroom. That's way more than the £9 billion she had last year. So hopefully, fingers crossed, she won't be doing another budget like this ever again. But then again, we did say that last year, didn't we? So
I mean, for people hoping that things weren't going to happen, that £2 million for the mansion tax, that's the point at which it will be introduced. It will taper after that. Temporary cuts to energy prices.
Yes. No details on that. I'm looking at that now.
The two-child cap is going. The two-child cap has been abolished. The tax thresholds have been frozen, which will see more people move into higher bands for their income tax. The mileage-based charge on electric cars seems to be coming in, so a few people driving electric cars might be a little bit unhappy about that. And the national insurance changes to pension contributions are going ahead as well. Growth forecasts have been downgraded, as have real disposable income forecasts. So it's not a leak of the speech, it's a leak of the detail. Is that right? So so her explanations for things and her citing of causes we will wait for, but the consequences of whatever it is she explains has caused these things, we are already examining.
Yeah, so this is the OBR basically measuring whether the Treasury sums add up, how much it's all going to cost, where the money's going to come from, where it's being moved around in the Treasury, who's paying more, who's paying less, what it means for the Chancellor's sort of, you know, economic health of the nation, I guess. But yes, the tax take is going to go up to 38% of GDP. That's another new high. That's not a surprise to any of us who follow British politics. Every single budget, it seems to go up slightly. It's including £26 billion of new tax rises, so a pretty significant chunk. It's not on the same scale that we saw last year. I think that was around £40 billion worth of tax rises. And of course, Rachel Reeves did borrow a lot of that money as well. You're correct. The government has decided to remove the two-child limit with a universal credit. That's going to come in April 2026. That's going to be a real sock,
quite soon, isn't it? That's less than a year. I think the mansion tax, so-called mansion tax, doesn't kick in until 2028.
It's people. Not raising very much money at all. It's £0.4 billion for that that high-value council surcharge. But the two-child limit, that is totally something being thrown at the Labour backbench.
This is what I meant earlier about a variety of audiences, because this doesn't actually play well with the electorate at large, but it plays very well with Labour MPs.
Exactly, and Rachel Reeves knows that. In order to get this budget to land well, it needs to land well with the markets, it needs to land well with Labour MPs, it needs to land well with the public, and of course businesses too. So lots of different audiences, you're right, that Rachel Reeves is aiming at today, and the two-child benefit limit squarely, aimed at Labour MPs who have been, let's fair to say, very grumpy over the past year or so.
And of course the headline writers have gone early, but the headlines wouldn't be any different according to when the detail reached the people. You're looking at the two-child benefit cap and the millions of people who will be paying more tax as a consequence of the freezing of these thresholds until the end of the 2030-2031 financial year. So the point at which you become eligible to pay more tax on your income above that threshold isn't going to change for 5.5 years or for the best part of 5 years. Thank you, Natasha. Sheila Fogarty will of course be piloting our coverage as Rachel Reeves delivers the actual speech containing all of the detail which the World and his wife is currently poring over. I don't know. Does this make you more excited about the coming hour or so, Sheila, or less excited?
I'm very excited.
Of course you are. We're all very excited.
We're all very excited. Well, I mean, in a way we should be, because we'll obviously be talking a lot about the economy and our money and what she intends to do with it, what the government intends to do with it. But it's a big political moment as well, and I'm sure Natasha will agree. But with that, it's a huge moment for both the Chancellor and for the Prime Minister. And there will be people saying, and we'll find out eventually, I guess, people saying, hang on, about this leak from the OBR. Was it a leak? Was it an error? Or was it someone's attempt to destabilise the two leading figures in the government, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor? We don't know yet what the truth or otherwise of that is, but it's a massive moment politically as much as it is economically. And it's interesting what you said there, James, about those thresholds and the amount of time people will have before those changes kick in. The reality is it's still going to be noticed by them. It still raises, I think, something like 40 billion, which isn't that far different from what a general raise in income tax would have raised as well. So income tax is going up, and it'll be the electorate that decides whether that's a promise broken or not. But I don't think anyone can call it a stealth tax, that's for sure.
Inflation looking to be a little bit higher than previously thought, according to the OBR's predictions. 3.2 back in March, 3.5 for this year now, and similarly next year's forecast up from 2.1% to 2.5%. Mm-hmm. Pension contributions to be taxed above £2,000. This is what's called a salary sacrificed pension contribution. That has a £2,000 threshold and will no longer be exempt from national insurance contributions. I've heard various people use the word smorgasbord.
I like that word.
It works, doesn't it? Does that make it harder or easier to dig into later, Sheila? The fact that there is so many little things as opposed to one big thing.
I don't think it makes it harder or easier, actually. But on what you've just described there, the salary sacrifice element, I think what we should also listen out for alongside that is the plans for ISAs and the tax-free element of ISAs and ISA limits. Because whether we save is really important, and we're not a great nation of savers. How we save is something that the Chancellor has been explicit about. She wants us to be more natural savers and investors, as she would call it, in stocks and shares, including ISAs, stocks and share ISAs. Now, the kind of culture of saving in this country, I think, isn't there yet. For some people it will be, but not for many. Saving through your workplace pension is. Saving because you're saving cash in a bank account or in a savings account is. And I wonder whether these decisions on the salary sacrifice and ISAs, which we'll hear about, whether they are, in a sense, a bit of nudge theory happening. It's the Chancellor trying to get us to save differently, because removing the exemption of national insurance from employers on that salary sacrifice pension will probably make some companies decide not to offer it. And that is a bad thing, I think, when it comes to people saving.
All of this to dig into. I've got the actual numbers on the high-value council tax surcharge, or the mansion tax, as it is rather more popularly known, which affects a vanishingly small number of householders in this country, but assumes a political salience rather disproportionate to its impact. There will be four price bands with the surcharge, rising from £2,500 per year for a property valued in the lowest band, which will be £2 million to £2.5 million. The cut-off point for the highest band is £5 million. So somebody with a house worth £5.1 million will be paying the same as somebody with a house worth £500 million, which is an even more vanishingly small constituent of the people listening to this programme. And they will be paying £7,500 a year. So the most you will be paying per year for your property tax is £7,500, and the least that you'll be paying is £2,500.
That's on top of your council tax, though, I believe.
Yes, it's a surcharge, not a charge.
It's a hell of a lot, £7,500.
If your house is worth more than £5 million.
Oh, still, though.
Per year. Do you want to get your tiny violin out? I'll get my kazoo.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's quite a lot to ask somebody to pay in one go. I wonder if you'll be able to spread your payments. But yeah, you're right. If you're a billionaire, Natasha, I'm sure you won't be blinking.
Not only can you spread your payments, you can pay when you die if you feel you can't budget for it.
Well, I probably can't. Me and my £5 million flat will be looking into this option.
I'm minded to point out that if you are living in a £5.5 million flat and you can't find £7,500 a year, it's probably down the back of your sofa.
Probably. Well, I mean, you just sell the sofa instead.
I think on this tax, not that I live in a £2 million property, just to get that clear from the start, £2 million is probably rather different, isn't it? People can find that they now live in a £2 million house, so they could still have their grown-up children living in. It could be regarded as their pension. It could be regarded as their care costs. You know, there's a lot in a house these days other than the sofa and the money down the back of it.
Indeed there is. And I will be on the hook for some of this, but I haven't quite worked out how much yet. But the...
Should we go through the bands again?
Bottom line is 2028... 20, that one kicks in. So if you are worried about...
I've got some time to save up, is what you're saying.
Or you can move. If you're worried about your ability to find £2.5 grand a year to live in a house worth £2.4 million, then there's plenty of time for you to move. We're back in that zone where we are waiting for the Chancellor now to get to her feet in the House of Commons. So we have a quick word from the Shadow Chancellor, who I'm told is making a point of order at the moment. This is Mel Stride.
This report contains market-sensitive information. It is utterly outrageous that this has happened. And this leak may indeed constitute a criminal act. In Prime Minister's questions, the Leader of the Opposition asked the Prime Minister about this leak, but he refused to answer her question.
He knows nothing about it.
So, Madam Deputy Speaker, please can you advise this House what steps are at its disposal to force a leak inquiry into this matter? And would it be possible to ask the Table Office to distribute copies of the report given to the House, given that everybody outside of this House has already had the opportunity to read it?
Order! This is not a point of order for the Chair. The Chancellor is about to make her budget statement, and I expect members and their constituents wish to hear from the Chancellor directly. However, before I call the Chancellor to speak, I nonetheless wish to make a short statement. For a number of weeks, and yet again yesterday, there have been extensive briefings to the media on the government's fiscal policy and public finances. This disappointing trend in relation to budget briefings has been growing for a number of years under successive governments, but appears to have reached an unprecedented high. Weeks ago, we saw the Chancellor delivering a speech in Downing Street, setting the scene for the budget, as well as specific policy announcements being briefed out to the media in advance of today's financial statements. I don't need any help. And just a moment ago, it seems the OBR analysis has also appeared online. This all falls short of standards that the House expects. The premature disclosure of the contents of the budget has always been regarded as a supreme discourtesy to this House and to all the democratically elected members, not to mention to Mr. Speaker and to myself, the Chairman of Ways and Means. The government's own ministerial code cannot be clearer, as set out in paragraph 9.1. When Parliament is in session, the most important announcements of government policy should be made in the first instance to Parliament. Mr. Speaker has always upheld the rights of this House and its members to be treated with respect and to be the first to hear major government policy announcements on behalf of their constituents. As Chairman of Ways and Means, I have responsibility to oversee the House's consideration of the budget statement and the ensuing resolutions, which are described in Erskine May, paragraph 36-33, as the most important business of Ways and Means in this House. I want honourable members on all sides of the House to have adequate opportunity to hold the Chancellor to account rather than hear and read about new policies on a daily basis in the media. And like many, I also expected better. Before I call the Chancellor of the Exchequer, I remind honourable members that copies of the budget resolutions will be available to them from the Vote Office in members' lobby at the end of the Chancellor's statement and online. I also remind honourable members that interventions are not taken during the Chancellor's statement, nor during replies to the Leader of the Opposition or the Leader of the Liberal Democrats. I call the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Chancellor.
Madam Deputy Speaker, it is my understanding that the Office of Budget Responsibility's Economic and Financial Outlook was released on their website before this statement. This is deeply disappointing and a serious error on their part. The Office of Budget Responsibility have already made a statement taking full responsibility for their breach. Deputy Speaker, we are rebuilding our economy. Over the last 16 months, We have overhauled our planning system to get Britain building, forged new trade deals with the United States, India, and the European Union. Reformed our visa system to bring the brightest and the best to Britain. We changed our fiscal rules that we inherited from the Conservatives and raised public investment to its highest level in 4 decades. And in last year's budget, I raised taxes on business and the wealthiest to close the £22 billion black hole in the public finances left by the party opposites. And we used that money to fund the biggest ever settlement for our National Health Service. They were the fair and necessary choices. And we faced opposition to them, from opponents to planning reform, who will always demand that the future is built somewhere else, not in their backyard. Opponents to trade, who want to take us down the path of isolation and division. Opponents to investment, who believe that the only good thing a government can do is get out of the way. Opponents who insist that the only way to balance the books is to cut public spending. And opponents who say that we don't need to balance the books at all. But we made these choices for a reason. Because after 14 years of Conservative government, working people demanded and deserved change. Yeah. Investment, not cuts to our public services. Stability for our public finances. The single most important factor in getting the cost of living down. And economic growth. The best means to improve wages, create jobs, and support public services. That is what our plan, that is what this government and our Prime Minister are all about. Today's budget builds on the choices that we have made since July last year. To cut NHS waiting lists, to cut the cost of living, and to cut debt and borrowing. No doubt we will face opposition again, but I have yet to see a credible or a fairer alternative plan for working people. These are my choices, the right choices for a fairer, a stronger and more secure Britain.
Order. Far too much noise, and I expected so much better from you, Dr. Luke Evans. You're meant to be a leader in your community. Simmer down, Chancellor.
I'm happy for them to shout as much as they like, Madam Deputy Speaker, as long as they do it from the opposition benches where they can't cause any more damage. I said there would be no return to austerity, and I meant it. This budget will maintain investment in our economy and in our National Health Service. I said I would cut the cost of living, and I meant it. This budget will bring down inflation and provide immediate relief for families. I said I would cut debt and borrowing, and I meant it. Because of this budget, borrowing will fall as a share of GDP in every year of this forecast. Our net financial debt will be lower at the end of the forecast than it is today. And I will more than double the headroom against our stability rule to £21.7 billion, meeting our stability rule and meeting it a year early. These are my choices. Not austerity, not borrowing, not turning a blind eye to unfairness. My choices are a budget for fair taxes, strong public services and a stable economy. That is the Labour choice. Growth is the engine that carries every one of our ambitions forward through stability, investment and reform. The platform from which British ambition can finally get moving again. Because growth doesn't just appear out of thin air. It is built patiently and stubbornly by people who take risks, by founders who bet their savings on an idea, by firms breaking into new markets,
developing new technologies and creating new jobs and new opportunities. By the men and the women who work hard every day in all parts of our country. Our job is not to watch from the sidelines, but to partner with them, backing them every step of the way, to match private enterprise with public ambition. I would like to thank my team of officials at the Treasury for their hard work in preparing this budget. In the spring, the Office of Budget Responsibility forecast that our economy would grow by 1% this year. I said then that Britain would defy the forecasts, and defy them we have. The OBR have upgraded Britain's growth for this year from 1% to 1.5%. Have published the result of their review of the supply side of the economy. They are clear that this is not about the last 14 months. It is about the previous 14 years. The legacy of Brexit and the pandemic and the damaging decisions by the party opposite. Cutting public spending, leaving communities and entire regions behind, starving our economy of investment and weakening our public services. As a result of their review, the OBR are reducing their expectations for productivity growth by 0.3 percentage points to 1% by the end of the forecast. They say today, and I quote, real GDP is forecast to grow by 1.5% on average over the forecast due to lower underlying productivity growth. There is an impact on our public finances too. The OBR say that their productivity forecast will mean £16 billion less in tax receipts by 2030. These forecasts are the Tories' legacy, not Britain's.
Order. It is very hard to hear the Chancellor over all the shouting. And Mr. Holmes, you promised me yesterday you were going to be on top behaviour in the first few minutes. Chancellor.
We beat the forecasts this year and we will beat them again. By boosting trade, not blocking it. By increasing investment, not cutting it. By championing innovation, not stifling it. By backing working people, not making them poorer. Brick by brick, we've been building our economy. Building roads, building homes, getting spades in the ground and cranes in the sky. Growth begins with the spark of an entrepreneur. Half of new jobs in Britain are created by scale-up businesses. And we want those jobs created here, not somewhere else. Our job is to make Britain the best place in the world to start up, to scale up and to stay. So we're widening eligibility for our enterprise incentives. So scale-ups can attract the talent and the capital that they need. Expanding the enterprise management incentive so more companies can offer tax-relief share options. Re-engineering our enterprise investment and venture capital trust schemes so they don't just back early stage ideas, but stay with companies as they grow. Introducing UK listings relief. A 3-year exemption from stamp duty reserve tax for companies who choose to list here in Britain. And to continue this work, I am launching a call for evidence on how our tax system can better back entrepreneurs and a targeted review with founders and investors at the heart to make the UK an even more attractive place to grow your business. We are sending a simple message to the world. If you build here, Britain will back you. And our retail investment system should do the same. The UK has some of the lowest levels of retail investment in the G7. And that is not only bad for business, who need that investment to grow, it's bad for savers too. Someone who has invested £1,000 a year in an average stocks and shares ISA every year since 1999 would be £50,000 better off today if they'd put that same money into a, than if they'd put them same money into a cash ISA. And so from April 2027, I will reform our ISA system, keeping the full £20,000 allowance while designating 8,000 of it exclusively for investment, with over 65s retaining the full cash allowance. And thanks to our changes to financial advice and guidance, banks will be able to guide savers to better choices for their hard-earned money. Over 50% of the ISA market, including Hargreaves Lansdowne, HSBC, Lloyds, Vanguard and Barclays, have signed up to launch new online hubs to help people invest here in Britain. Yeah. At this budget, consistent with the commitments in our corporate tax roadmap, I will retain our competitive corporation tax rate, the lowest in the G7, and retain our generous full expensing offer for business investments. I will also introduce a new 40% first-year allowance so that businesses can write off more of the cost of their investment up front, while reducing main rate writing down allowances in line with fiscal constraints. Private investment is the lifeblood of economic growth, but growth needs public investment too. When faced with challenges, previous chancellors have chosen to decrease, delay, or cancel capital spending. But low investment is the cause of our productivity problem, not the solution. So my choice is not cuts, not stagnation, but to maintain the additional £120 billion of investment that I provided at the spending review. In transport to link our towns and our cities, energy infrastructure to power our businesses, and housing so people can live near good jobs, paying decent wages and growing businesses. That is the Labour choice. I'm grateful to the Financial Secretary to the Treasury for his work in driving our growth agenda forward. As we allocate investment for the infrastructure that is the backbone of economic growth across our country, today I will commit investment for the Lower Thames Crossing. And we're continuing to drive investment in city region transport, in the Midlands Rail Hub and the Transpennine Route upgrade, along with our commitments to the Northern Growth Corridor, including Northern Powerhouse Rail. Yeah. It is this Labour government that has overhauled our planning system, and I will today provide further funding to increase planning capacity through a new skills offer, as called for by the British Chamber of Commerce and the Confederation of British Industry. Yeah. It is this Labour government that has invested in nuclear power, in Sizewell C and in Culham. We are taking forward our commitment to slash electricity prices for thousands of manufacturing businesses, as Make UK and many others have called for. And today I'm pleased to welcome John Finkelton's report, an ambitious plan to cut the red tape that has tied our nuclear industry in knots for decades. And within 3 months we will set out our plan for delivering his recommendations. We are proud of our industrial heritage, and we are determined to build the industry of the future so that we buy, make and sell more here in Britain. That's why, as we increase defence spending, we are investing in Portsmouth, in Barrow and in Plymouth. And I'm pleased to be supporting Team Derby, an initiative to drive growth in one of our defence industry hubs. It's why we stepped in to save British Steel in Scunthorpe and invested in Sheffield Forge Masters. And it's why we've changed government procurement so we can buy British when it is crucial to our national security. For steel, for shipbuilding, and today for AI, driving innovation and building that great industry here in Britain. But it's not just what we invest that matters, it's how we invest. Putting money and power back in the hands of local and regional leaders. Today we are devolving £13 billion of flexible funding for seven mayors to invest in skills, business support and infrastructure. I'm extending the business rates retention pilots in the west of England, Liverpool City region and Cornwall until 2029. And providing £30 million for the Curno Industrial Growth Fund for sectors like critical minerals and marine innovation. I am establishing the Lead City Fund, a long-term agreement to retain business rates to fund local regeneration projects like the development of Leeds South Bank, and I am allocating £20 million for the new Peterborough Sports Quarter and £16 million for a science centre in Darlington from the Growth Mission Fund. The benefits of investment... of investment and growth must be built and felt in every part of our United Kingdom. So we are providing an additional £370 million for the Northern Ireland Executive, £505 million for the Welsh Government and £820 million for the Scottish Government over the spending review period through the Barnett formula. And I am making... Sorry, I didn't quite catch that from the SNP. £20 million for the Scottish Government over the spending review period because Anas Sawar asked us to. Yeah. And I'm making targeted investments in our industrial strategy sectors across the UK. In Northern Ireland, I am providing £17 million to support businesses and strengthen the UK internal market. I'm backing advanced manufacturing through the Northern Ireland Enhanced Investment Zone. Wales will be the host for two AI growth zones, creating more than 8,000 jobs, supported by a £10 million investment in the semiconductors critical for that industry. And we are building the UK's first small modular nuclear reactors with Rolls-Royce at Wilfer in Anglesey. Two Labour governments working together in Wales to deliver for the people of Wales. And in Scotland, I'm committing over £14 million for low-carbon technologies in Grangemouth, £20 million to renew infrastructure at Inch Green in Inverclyde, and £20 million to redevelop Kirkcaldy Town Centre and Seafront, with construction starting next year. And that's on top of the UK's biggest ever warship export deal with the Norwegian government to build frigates in Glasgow. Supporting 4,000 jobs, investment opposed by the SNP, jobs opposed by the SNP, defence opposed by the SNP, but secured by this Labour government. A growing economy needs strong foundations of economic stability, with borrowing, inflation down and investment up. That is good for business, and it is good for working people, so they have more money in their pockets. Economic stability, safeguarded by ironclad fiscal rules, is our best defence against rising prices and the best way to improve living standards. We've all seen the alternative. 3 years ago, in their clamour to cut taxes for the richest, the Tories under Liz Truss crashed the economy and sent mortgage rates spiralling and brought pensions to the brink. Speaker, and yet I can't even hear them now. Now, I know that the leader of the Green Party is a keen hypnotherapist, and he believes that he can achieve remarkable things using only the power of his mind. Unfortunately, the only things getting bigger under his approach would be the deficit and the rate of inflation. Damage that the Conservative cuts did to our schools and our hospitals, they also doubled the national debt. Our net financial debt this year will be £2.6 trillion, 83% of GDP, meaning that today, one in every £10 that government spends is on debt interest. Not on paying down that debt, but just on paying the interest on the debt that we inherited from the Conservatives. fiscal rules will get borrowing down while supporting investment. The stability rule, that day-to-day expenditure must be met through tax receipts. And the investment rule, which allows me to increase investment whilst getting debt on a downward path. Those fiscal rules are non-negotiable. I met them at the budget last year, I met them in the spring, and I have met them today. While the current budget balance is in deficit by £28.8 billion in 26-27 and £4.6 billion in 27-28, it moves into a surplus of £3.9 billion in 28-29, £21.7 billion in 29-30, and £24.6 billion in 2030-31. More than doubling our headroom against the stability rule and meeting that rule a year early too. Yeah. And our net financial debt is 83.3% in 26-27, 83.6% in 27-28, 83.7% in 28-29, falling to 83.0% in 29-30 and 82.2% in 2030-31. Madam Deputy Speaker, I said we would cut the debt and we are, with debt down by the end of the forecast. And going forwards, to support our commitment to a single fiscal event and further strengthen our economic stability, I will follow the recommendations of the International Monetary Fund by assessing the fiscal rules just once a year at the budget. Despite the challenges we face on productivity, the path of our deficit reduction remains broadly the same as in spring. Public sector net borrowing is due to be £112.1 billion, or 3.5% of GDP in 26-27, 3% in 27-28, 2.6% in 28-29, 1.9% in 29-30, and 1.9% in 2030-31, ending at £67.2 billion. Translating into an increase in the net cash requirement next year of £4.2 billion, taking the total to £133.3 billion. According to the IMF, we are due to reduce borrowing more over the rest of this Parliament than any other G7 economy. The Conservatives crashed the economy. We are protecting it. The Conservatives lost control of debt. We are getting debt down. The Conservatives let inflation and interest rates go through the roof. But, Madam Deputy Speaker, since Labour took office, the Bank of England have cut interest rates 5 times. I've made my choices. Not reckless borrowing. Not dangerous cuts, but stability for our economy, security for our public finances, and security for family finances too. Those are the Labour choices. Yeah. Madam Deputy Speaker, Tory austerity left classrooms crumbling and waiting lists sky high, weakened our productivity and choked our economic growth. And now they propose a further £47 billion of cuts to our public services. Well, that is equivalent to cutting every police officer in our country twice over. And then there is Reform, who promise more than £100 billion of cuts, with no details of where those cuts will come from or who will pay for them. A recipe for devastating damage to our public services. People voted for Labour because they wanted roads that aren't full of potholes. They want police on our streets and they want an NHS that is there when they need it. And we're delivering that. Waiting lists down by 230,000. And not just the 2 million additional appointments we promised, but an additional 5.2 million appointments already delivered since the general election. I joined the Labour Party almost 30 years ago because I could see that the Conservative government that I grew up under didn't care much about schools like mine. Textbooks were rationed. I know that many of you weren't at schools like mine.
There is far too much noise, far too much excitement. People need to calm down a little. Chancellor.
Yeah.
They don't want never hear what the Tories did to schools like mine, but I will tell them. Textbooks rationed, libraries closed, kids herded into porter cabins in the playground, and I came into politics to change that. The money that I allocated at the spending review will fix the crumbling classrooms that the Conservatives left behind and build the schools that they promised but never delivered. And today, thanks to representations from my honourable friends, the members for Wolverhampton North East and Leeds South West and Morley, I will provide £5 million for libraries in secondary schools. Building on the £10 million commitment to ensure that every primary school has a school library within this Parliament. And thanks to representations from my honourable friends, the members for Bournemouth East and from Luton North, I am providing £18 million to improve and upgrade playgrounds across England. Madam Deputy Speaker, let there be no doubt that this is a government that is on the side of our kids and who will back their potential. I will not allow the legacies of Conservative neglect to stain our society. Last year, I made changes to the mine workers' pension scheme to ensure that its members receive the fair pensions that they are owed. This year, with thanks to the Minister for Pensions for all his work in this subject, I can go further. I have heard representations from Labour Coalfield MPs, including my honourable friends, the members for Bassetlaw, Blythe and Ashington, Barnsley South, Mansfield and Clonethley. And today I can announce that I will transfer the Investment Reserve Fund of the British Coal Staff Superannuation Scheme to its members. So that the men and the women who worked in our coal industry get a fair deal in their retirement too. And more. Having heard representations from my honourable friends, the members for Banbury and the member for Edinburgh South West, I will index for inflation on pensions accrued before 1997 in the Pension Protection Fund and the Financial Assurance Scheme, so that people whose pension schemes became insolvent, no fault of their own, no longer lose out as a result of inflation. Last year, I also provided funding to compensate the victims of the infected blood scandal, after the previous government failed to budget for the costs of compensation. This year, I have listened to representations from my honourable friend, the member for Eltham and Chislehurst, and my honourable friend, the member for Edinburgh South West. And I'd like to thank the Minister for Employment for her representations over many years on this subject. As a result, I will exempt all payments from the infected blood scheme from inheritance tax, regardless of the circumstances in which those payments are passed down. Yeah. Madam Deputy Speaker, that is how we should be spending taxpayers' money, on dealing with injustices and building strong public services, not on waste and inefficiency. At the spending review, I set an ambitious target of £14 billion of efficiencies per year by 2029, and I am grateful to the Chief Secretary to the Treasury for driving that work forward, realising savings through AI and automation, and by scrapping NHS England and reducing back-office staff by 18,000. At this budget, I will find a further £4.9 billion of efficiencies by 2031. Getting rid of police and crime commissioners, cutting the cost of politics and local government, and selling government assets that we no longer have any use for. These savings will be required across government. But for our National Health Service, I will reinvest all of these savings back into the care that people rely on. Yeah. More nurses, more GPs, more appointments. Yeah. Restoring the services that faltered under years of Conservative decline and investing in the future of our National Health Service. Yeah. And today I am announcing £300 million of investment in technology to improve patient service and 250 new neighbourhood health centres. Expanding more services into communities so that people can receive treatment outside of hospitals and get better, faster care where they live. A Over 100 of these will be delivered by 2030, including in Birmingham, Truro and Southall. The Labour Party founded our National Health Service and we will renew our National Health Service. I will take the same approach for defence spending that I take to NHS spending, reinvesting savings back into our national security. In our age of insecurity, Britain will continue to stand with our allies, working in collaboration to secure a sustainable ceasefire for Ukraine and maintaining our commitment to NATO, with the UK set to spend 2.6% of GDP on defence by April 2027. Madam Deputy Speaker, the public rightly expects that we stamp out fraud, error and waste and put that money to good use in our schools and our hospitals and our other frontline services. My right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, has already announced that she will claw back excess profits from the use of hotels to house asylum seekers as we phase out the use of those hotels entirely. And we will consult on reforms to indefinite leave to remain and access to taxpayer-funded benefits. The introduction of digital ID will break the link between illegal migration and illegal working. And the HMRC and the Fair Work Agency will crack down on illicit businesses that blight our high streets and undercut illegitimate firms, enforcing the minimum wage, investigating dodgy businesses and increasing scrutiny of the gig economy, as well as tracking down fraudulent business owners who vanish without paying their taxes. And I'd like to thank my honourable friends, the members for Great Grimsby and Cleethorpes, Lee and Atherton and Kensington and Bayswater for their representations on this subject. And I'll take further steps to prevent and track down unpaid tax, which will together, these reforms, will raise nearly £10 billion a year by 2030, including through new powers for HMRC to pursue the promoters of tax avoidance schemes. I am building on our successful use of targeted checks on welfare claims to root out fraud and error and prevent public money being paid to people who are not entitled to it. And I would like to thank Tom Hayhoe, the COVID Corruption Commissioner, for his work in helping to chase down nearly £400 million from dodgy pandemic spending and contracts. Contracts handed out by Tory ministers to Tory peers and Tory friends. Well, that money belongs in our schools and in our hospitals.
Noisy now, we can barely hear.
It is very noisy in the House of Commons as Rachel Reeves delivers her budget speech. You're listening to Sheila Fogarty on LBC. You can stream the whole show live on the LBC app and listen in the usual way on the radio and on Global Player. An awful lot of you are texting to say this noise, this shouting, this screaming is like listening to a bunch of unruly kids. I fear it's going to continue, but the Chancellor is managing to be heard, so we'll go back to that speech. Stay with LBC.
Hospitals, and we are getting that money back. And finally, Madam Deputy Speaker, we are ramping up sanctions on Russia and we are freezing known Russian assets. But let me be clear, I don't actually mean the Honourable Member for Clacton. Under the Conservatives.
You don't need commentary from the back benches, and Mr. Dewhurst, you are so loud. It's remarkable how far your voice carries. Chancellor!
Under the Conservatives, the cost of our welfare system increased by nearly one percentage point of GDP, equivalent